these organizations have to go through to...
The House Committee on Education will come to order. Okay. Today is Wednesday, January 13th. It's a little after 8 a.m., and this is our January interim committee meeting. As you all know, part of the goal of the meetings this week on the House side is preparing for our February session. So the legislative concepts and the bills that we'll be hearing today are a combination of individual member bills that are going to be referred to our committee in February, and also the legislative concepts that we intend to have introduced as House Education Committee concepts for February. We have a couple of members who are here. We also have Senator Devlin, who's going to be coming in a couple of minutes to do the online learning task force, so we might skip around a little bit. But we do have a very full agenda today. I know that's unusual for this committee to have a lot of items on the agenda, and I expect there will be a lot of testimony. For those that are here to testify on any of the issues that we have, please keep in mind that we're going to have to be fairly strict with the time. We're asking people to keep your testimony to about 3 minutes, if possible, so that we can try to get through all of the topics we have on the agenda today and hopefully get everyone who's come have the opportunity to get up, and we will do our best to do that, depending on how the time is managed at the witness stand. So is there anything for the good of the order before we start from the committee? No? Great. Well, I would open a public hearing. So we're going to skip ahead to a public hearing on House Bill 3628. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21. This bill is really, you'll end up seeing a lot of names on here. It's really the byproduct of Representative Richardson's delegation that he leads or that he organizes, and depending on who the if the governor is going or the speaker, then technically they're called the leader, but we all know that Dennis is the one who sort of organizes it, and everybody hugs when we first get there because he's our leader of our delegation. While in China, had the opportunity to visit with the Ministry of Education there, and they talked about a thing that they do that some schools in Oregon are taking advantage of already, where they will actually pay the salaries of Mandarin instructors for the school district if the school district is interested, and if they will provide housing and transportation that they would make available a teacher who has taught in their school system for 3 years to come and live in the U.S. and teach Mandarin rather than the school district having to find somebody and pay their salary. And we were all quite fascinated. Representative Maurer was there. He can share, I'm sure. But we were all quite intrigued with that. Some of us talked to our superintendents, and there was a fair amount of interest in different districts. What this bill would do is allow for one statewide framework agreement to be made rather than every single school district having to make a contract, which is currently the case. This would allow for one to be made by the superintendent of public instruction, and then the other school districts can just essentially take advantage of the terms of that contract rather than the current process, which is each one negotiates individually. So PSU has one already, U of O has one, there's a St. Mary's school, they have one, and we just thought it was not a very good use of time or district money to keep negotiating this. We also think there's a chance we could actually get more benefits paid for by the other side of the agreement if we offered up sort of a state-to-government contract or state-to-China contract rather than a school district to China contract over and over. For example, maybe they would pay for the health care where normally that would be on the school district. And that's the basic function. We had a conference call. We were trying to figure out who would actually be the correct signator on something like this. Would it be the governor? Would it be the Speaker of the House if we're trying to get the Legislative Assembly involved? So our thought as a group was let's authorize the Superintendent of Public Instruction to do it. And if we pass a bill to authorize that, then the legislative bodies also sort of signed off on that process. So it's got sort of multiple, it's not bicameral, but whatever, the other branches have all been included in this, legislative and executive have been included in this agreement. And that's the basic nature of the bill. If you look at the bill, it just basically authorizes the Superintendent of Public Instruction to enter into a contract to make the Chinese language available. And there is essentially one entity that we have in mind, though this is not specific to that one entity. It just says public nonprofit and specializes in the teaching of Mandarin dialect. We've had conversations with the superintendent and her office, and they're certainly welcome and interested. We have some more details we'd have to work out to actually get a contract signed, but this would just sort of authorize and put a stamp of approval from the legislature that we're interested in having Mandarin taught in our schools.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Clem? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gilsert. So this is a contract with China, the country?
They have an institute. It's called the Hanban, and it's a portion of their Ministry of Education, which is in their government. So they have a nonprofit international governing board for this institute, which includes other members from other countries. But this thing is called the Hanban, and it's got an affiliation though with their Ministry of Education, much like our U.S. Department of Education.
Thank you,
Representative Maurer.
Thank you. This is more of a comment. The U.S. Department of Education is also in a relationship with this organization because our Southern Oregon ESD took advantage of a granting program through the same thing. And so when I talked to my school district about it, they said, well, we think we're kind of doing something already. And in fact, they started this after-school program, or we'll start it in the next week or so. Mm-hmm. I think this is a very important step. Since because we're on the Pacific Rim, we are very well positioned to take advantage of it.
Thank you. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Representative Clem, and I don't expect you to know this history, but we sponsored a couple of Russian citizens 20 years ago to come to Woodburn to teach our Russian language. And I would hate to have this just confined to Mandarin. Was there discussion about expanding this to other foreign nationals to come and speak these, teach in these languages and teach these languages?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kopp. I believe that it's very likely the superintendent already has contracts with other countries. In fact, I'm pretty sure of it because I got an email back saying we already have a couple with other countries.
Okay.
So there's nothing that would preclude that. We just wanted to, this particular delegation of folks wanted to specifically authorize and call out with this agreement.
To make it inclusive.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I guess my biggest question, and it goes right to the part, is it going to be high school, elementary, middle school? Could it be any and all of the above? And then certification, does it qualify if it was a high school course so they could actually get credit for those things? And how do we go about finding out the backgrounds of those people we're going to be giving to our kids to teach them?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, currently they make available two types. One is if it's K-12, somewhere in there they call it the Confucius Classroom, and we've got one of those in Oregon currently at least. If it is at a university, and they do offer both, then it's called a Confucius Institute. And so PSU and U of O have Confucius Institute, and then we have one at least, a Confucius Classroom. So it's available all the way K-16.
Follow up.
Yeah, just because you mentioned it was a private school, I think, that has the one.
St. Mary's, yeah.
And they have different certification requirements.
Yeah, I was going to get to the certification part. Sorry.
Okay.
So this bill doesn't speak to that one way or the other, but the feedback I already received from the Department of Education is that in the cases where they have other contracts already with other countries, and they have, I think, two, they still require certification, and from TSPC, actually, our TSPC. And so this is not to interfere with that in this bill, but my understanding is that TSPC has been trying to work on some sort of international agreement or international board, and we're sort of hopeful that we'd be able to get that completed and take advantage of that, and that way, you know, we know that the background checks have been done, and but in this bill, we're not trying to exempt from that requirement that's currently there that somebody be a licensed person. We're trying to work through the TSPC process to see if they can come up with an agreement that would make it sufficient that there's been the due diligence done already by the Chinese government. But that's their process. I think it's been going on for a couple of years already, and it's heavily underway.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clem, how is this instruction delivered then down the road once the agreement's made and the instructor is here? How do we deliver that? Would it be done virtually so that it could be adapted to statewide?
Well, thank you for the question, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman. I think that they're fairly flexible, though I'm pretty sure current practice has just been literally a teacher in a classroom so far. Those are the examples we heard about, was the person comes, lives nearby somewhere, is in the classroom every day. But they expressed a lot of openness to proposals to do other kinds of things, including in some cases, if you already have a Mandarin instructor in mind, that is originated domestically, that they in some cases will pay that person instead. Their goal obviously is to promote Chinese language. We have to decide whether it's our goal to learn Chinese language, whether we think it's going to be useful or not. And this particular group that was there felt that it would be. So we could probably make a proposal for some other form of delivery, but that's the thing they talked about most, and they have 180 some around the world, most of them appeared to be teachers in the classroom, not virtual on a broader basis.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. If the department is already engaged in these contractual arrangements, why is this particular legislation necessary?
Very good question. I'm not entirely sure that it is, but the group that was there felt like there needed to be a specific role for the legislature in these agreements, at least particularly with China. And so our thought initially would be, if you're having a government-to-government agreement between the state of Oregon's government and the Chinese government, normally the governor would be doing that, not somebody else. And so by specifically authorizing the superintendent of public instruction, we felt that this was legislative sign-off and direction for somebody other than the speaker or the governor or the Senate president. And so we felt like by calling out specifically an authorization, it gave them a better footing for the superintendent to be operating from. Not to say that the other ones are invalid, but okay. We felt somewhat more comfortable knowing that the legislature would have signed off on this.
Thank you.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Klim, good idea. I think everybody on this committee anyway knows that I'm a strong proponent of learning multiple languages. I wish that I spoke Mandarin, but I don't. We have... The issue that you brought up is related to this, as is the issue that Representative Maurer mentioned. I'm a little concerned about the specificity of the contract. We have a contract somewhere in the past that was issued related to SAT coverage by the state, and this language says we'll enter into a contract with an institution. It's very specific, and I wonder if we're setting ourselves up for potential conflict down the road. If this contract is let with an organization that's different from the one that's servicing your ESD, for example, we may inadvertently create some friction that we'll have to wrestle with, as we are wrestling, it seems, every session now with the SAT-ACT question. So I think maybe we ought to... What do you think about that?
So the question would probably be really for legislative council. If they entered into a contract here, would it mean they could never enter into another contract with a public nonprofit that specializes in teaching the Mandarin dialect? I don't know if it would end up prohibiting something like that. I would be a little surprised, but that's a legislative council question if this language actually would preclude them. I know that obviously in this case, like you described, we have a particular entity in mind that does it, but I don't know. If it's an LC question, probably.
Representative Maurer?
I was going to say, it's China. Everything out of China is out of one.
Are there any further questions or comments?
Yeah. You may wonder how I got the honor of doing this bill. I was the one who still hadn't had a member bill with 2 hours before the deadline when we were on the conference call. So that's how I ended up becoming the chief sponsor of the bill. Just for full disclosure.
Well, thank you very much for bringing it, and we will see you early in February.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3628 and open a public hearing on LC 135, which prohibits payment in exchange for enrollment in a K-12 school. And we're going to call up Cindy Hunt and Lori Wimmer. Dana, do you want to give a brief overview of what this is? And I want to put out a slight disclaimer. When we have a committee day, we have all of the things that we need to hear on the same day. That does not necessarily mean they are related to each other. This is not related to any of the virtual online schools that we will be talking about later. This is not a practice that is alleged to have happened through our ORCA or through ORVA. Just wanted to make that very clear. Dana.
So LC-135, the committee's actually seen two versions, so obviously the most current version is in front of you today. And it prohibits public charter schools, district school boards, or certain providers of educational services from offering money or other consideration to a student, that student's parents or legal guardians, in return for having the student elect to receive or receive educational services. So, and basically acting as an incentive to enroll. There are a couple exceptions. State Board can't provide a waiver from this requirement. The measure carries an emergency clause. We'd be effective upon passage.
Thank you. Lori?
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 47,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. We came in acquaintance with the issue that was the basis for this bill when we heard from one of our members a story about the rumor that a particular provider of educational services was offering parents a cash incentive to enroll their students in their public school. And so whether or not that actually occurred or whether or not it was a rumor was not for me the issue or for OEA the issue. The concern for us was, well, would that be illegal if it were true? And so I actually called Ms. Hunt over at the Department of Education just to learn about whether or not the statutes prohibited that. We found a loophole. We found that, in fact, there is not protection against that were someone to do that. And then subsequently we learned that there are some lesser versions of that, arrangements for a particular institution to pay tuition for private school services and that sort of thing that that may be going on. And so we thought that it would be an important hole to close up. And so for that reason, brought that forward.
Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. Good morning. When we first heard of this issue, it was about 6 months ago. We had been hearing rumors that parents were receiving money to send their kids to a particular charter school. We weren't able to substantiate it, though, at that time because it was kind of curious. We were a little surprised that that was going on. We asked a couple of schools, and they also were surprised, to be honest, that this was going on. They had expressed that they didn't have money in their budgets, frankly, to do that kind of behavior. So back in October, though, I was contacted by a school district who had had a parent that had sought to transfer their student into a charter school in their district. And the student had been accepted, and then the parent said, oh, but I don't want to transfer because I will lose $500 from my current charter school if I transfer in the middle of the semester. And so I asked the school district to give us any information about, you know, which school was doing it, the details, what the parent had said, that kind of thing. And so they submitted some information, and based on that, I was able to track down which school was doing it and what the relationship was based on the website of the school and also the private program they had the agreement with. And so based on this, what was happening was that some parents who had traditionally homeschooled their children were receiving up to $500 reimbursement for educational services they were purchasing from a private homeschool program. And it looked like that the parents got this if the kids remained enrolled for the whole semester. So that's what substantiated it. And then, of course, the school district, I think, had the same question that Lori had was, is it illegal? And it's not. Charter schools, school districts, are all allowed to pay parents an incentive. They are allowed to reimburse for educational services obtained, you know, at a variety of sources. I believe that in the traditional public school setting, that setting aside charter schools, there's some disincentives for them to do that. For example, a school district probably wouldn't want the schools in its district competing with each other for kids and spending money to do that.
for example. Also kids that participate in interscholastic activities. There are specific rules by the OSAA that would prohibit kind of recruitment and paying money to recruit students. But I think where it comes up sometimes with the charter schools is many of those students don't participate in sports and that kind of thing. So it's a little bit different because the students can go across school district boundaries. So unless there's any questions.
I bet there will be. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, actually. Cindy, on in the first sentence, because of the wording, I just want to make sure that that wording is sufficient to say that we're dealing only with K-12 or pre-K-12.
Yes, I believe it's sufficient that we're only dealing with K-12 because it uses the word public charter school. Charter schools are only K-12. District school boards only administer K-12. That provides under contract. Yeah, and then the second line talks about them having to have the contract with the charter school or the district school board. So unless the educational provider of services was offering higher ed and had a contract with the district school board, then it might reach out to higher ed in that way. But generally, this would just be K-12.
I'm not the attorney, so I wouldn't. I just wanted to make sure that we were speaking strictly of the pre-K-12. The second question is, Cindy, you and I had dialogued a little bit about this. On the task force for the virtual schools, we had learned that it's fairly common for a provider to provide instructional equipment, a computer, monitor, printer, online access, things of that nature. Will a virtual provider continue to be able to do that under this, okay, if it's been their customary practice?
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, I'm going to give you a good lawyer answer, which is it depends. And
that was the one you gave me.
I know.
The lawyer answer.
And the reason is this. I mean, one of the differences between the two drafts is the loan language, and that was frankly one of the reasons we had suggested the loan language, which was many of the examples that I know of where schools are supplying computers, instructional equipment, et cetera, the computers are on loan to the student. The student and the student's family enters into an agreement that when the student disenrolls, they're supposed to send back the equipment. And so that exception will cover a lot of the activity that's going on out there. However, for those schools that provide, let's take the example of a computer, and the student doesn't have to give it back. That's something of value. So then that's when you get into the depends. So then you have to look at, well, is it required by law for them to supply a computer? Well, for some virtual charter schools under Senate Bill 767, Senate Bill 767 does require them to supply a computer to certain low-income students or based on a plan for allowing access to their students. So for some students, some schools, still okay, it's required by law. But then for other charter schools and perhaps other public schools, it's not necessarily required by law that they supply a computer to every student. And it could be seen as an incentive. So this would it serve to, prohibit that kind of behavior. Did I answer your question?
Follow up. So,
doesn't look satisfied.
If my eighth grader is entering mm-hmm. ORCA, and part of ORCA's plan is to, on the online learning task force, I don't know that it was ever clear in my mind if computers are given or loaned. Mm-hmm. But are you saying that you walked away with typically they're on loan to the student?
Mm-hmm. Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, I have not done a survey of the schools. So this is based on anecdotal information that some of the schools have told me and some parents, frankly, have told me. And so I know that many of them, it's a loan. However, I also know that sitting behind me, there are representatives of some of the schools, and perhaps that's a good question for them, is to ask if they loan or if they give.
And just because we've entered this conversation again, I again want to make the clarification that this is not alleged to have been a problem with either of the virtual online schools that are represented in the audience today. Another follow-up?
Well, just based on that, as I read this, I just didn't want to create a problem
right.
that inadvertently that we weren't, that didn't need fixing, that.
Uh-huh.
Because I think when we were on the task force, we were thinking in terms of, we had heard the situation in terms of a cash payout. Mm-hmm. And so I know I was thinking cash at that point. But then when I read it, I thought, well, wait a minute, what about the equipment? So, thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on that, in order to have online education, you also have to have internet access. Internet access is often provided. It's not something you can return.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be, you know, used for other things, too, just because they have the internet access. Is that going to be seen as a gift?
Yeah. So, Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, in 767, for virtual charter schools, it talks about them allowing access to their services. And there's three ways that they can satisfy that. One is with internet access, computers another way, and then there's one that combines kind of internet and computers. And so arguably for virtual charter schools, so that subset, they could argue, well, it is required by law, and there's a big exception here. However, there are other schools, and so then it becomes whether or not the internet service is required for them to, for the students to receive the educational services that are required by the school to provide them by law. So I think that's the best answer I can give you.
Would it be similar to in a traditional brick-and-mortar charter school, students are given textbooks, consumable materials, all of the things that you would ordinarily need to access?
Yeah. Chair Gelser, in some cases, yes, I think so, because it would come down to whether or not it's part of the regular school program. So instructional materials that support the math class, those are required by law to be supplied, you know, and so that would not, you know, even if they were given to the student, I think most of the time those are loaned as well, but that those would not be covered by this. If there was a, but there is an issue out there as to whether or not virtual schools are required to supply computers specifically to their students. And it's not necessarily clear when you read the statutes relating to regular education versus the Senate Bill 767 statute. So for some cases, yes, but not necessarily. And the schools, when I talk to them, they are doing it in a variety of ways. I mean, the access question, I mean, by far not all of them are supplying the computers. I mean, that's clear. Some of them are inviting the students into a physical location, for example.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Roblin.
My concern has to do with providing opportunities for, say you have a TAG program in your community, in your school, and it says that we have a local community college, and for TAG students who have basically exhausted what we do at school, we will pay the tuition for those kids as part of their plan to go to the community college. Now, two other school districts around it don't offer that. So all of a sudden, there is an incentive for me, if I have a kid who meets those requirements, to get into that program because they're going to get opportunities to get a payment for community college because it's part of their program. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem?
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin, well, there's two exceptions or two pieces that I would point to. I think in the LC, it talks about the consideration being paid to the student or the parent. In many of the arrangements that I'm aware of, I believe the money is being paid directly to the college, and it's not necessarily to the student or the parent. For example, under the expanded options program that the schools are required to do, that's the case, is the money is paid to the college. It's not paid to the student or the parent. Also, under expanded options, it's required to be paid once the student enrolls. So then the other exception around what's legally required would kick in. So those two instances I'm aware of, this wouldn't prohibit that behavior.
Follow it.
So what if the district has an agreement with a program that says, we will reimburse you, your student takes the course. If they successfully complete it, we will reimburse you for that course. If they don't successfully reimburse it, they're not going to be reimbursed.
Yeah. So, Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin, then you'd have to look at the language, and is this being given as an incentive for that child to enroll in this particular school?
Is it offered to? Okay. I thought it was going to be a depends again. So,
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Roblin's question here just a little bit, it says here... read, I guess, the whole thing here. Public or private provider of educational services that provides educational services under contract or under other authority of a public charter school or district school board may not offer payment of money or other consideration. Mm-hmm. I've got to say that other consideration language is very, very problematic for me, and I think that ties into your point right there, Representative Roblin. Mm-hmm. So speak to me a little bit about that.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, other consideration, when I looked at this at first, I did see computers, because computers are a nice incentive. I mean, they are consideration. And other types of things. I think it could include, I don't know, any number of things. Some of the obvious would be the shiny new bike to enroll in the school or something. I think it's up to the legislature as to how you want to define that. You know, what is other consideration? I know that if this were to pass as written, I think the State Board of Education would kind of look at that and try to define it out a little bit more clearly. You know, what are we talking about? Probably something of value. You know, it wouldn't cover, you know, and think back to something like the public ethics laws, where it's not a pen, you know, it's not a brochure, it's something of value, you know, that the student's receiving. It has to be an incentive.
So we've got a lot of questions about this issue and another person that wants to testify, and Senator Devlin is here to speak about something else. So with your indulgence, I'm going to do one more question, and then we'll pause this hearing. And are you okay for a couple minutes?
Stay here as long as you need me to stay.
Thank you.
No, Senator Courtney calls me.
Where are you?
You give the Senate a very friendly face. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My concern follows Representative Springer. The issue is the potential of transfer of dollars. I think that really is probably the core issue here as an incentive. I don't think you're probably going to find much disagreement because, we don't want to steal students by giving them cash. I don't think that's appropriate. But the other consideration piece is that's where it gets much grayer for me. And, the trip to Disneyland, the shiny new bike I may not fall for, but the trip to Disneyland, that would be good. So I would actually like to see the language a little more restricted to exactly what we think really the worst egregious potential problem could be. Frankly, giving a kid a computer for a class, it's provided for educational services. And they can take that and abuse it however they want, because a lot of stuff is abused, unfortunately. But I would like to see the language a little more focused on what I think the core problem is.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'd like to see something like the wording non-educational in there, offering money or other non-educational consideration. Because then you could argue that the computer was for educational purposes. The shiny bike probably wouldn't be. So for me to support it, I think I'm going to have to see something like non-educational or something along those lines in there. That kind of isolates it to cash payout or the trip to Disneyland or something like that.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Well, the key point, though, is incentive. It's an incentive to make you switch from whatever you're doing to go to something else. And regardless of what it is, if it causes you to change what you're doing, it's an incentive. And I think for me, the key point here is incentive. It's an incentive to switch. And regardless of what you do, as long as they switch, to me that's the key point, is the incentive to switch. Or the incentive to enroll, period.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to briefly echo a couple of the concerns that I've heard here, and I find it a snapshot into the future, just our conversation here. We're all confused.
we're all confused, and it's hard to get a clear answer. And Cindy, that's not a disparaging remark against you, of course. And you said you're not the attorney, and that's the same line I use. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I said that.
So that said, I think we're looking at creating a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of unintended consequences for what may be a good idea, but yet do we have an issue that started from a rumor that really needs to be addressed? I'm kind of hearkening back to Senate Bill 10, where there were already laws in place to deal with some things, yet there's another law created to address it that created mass confusion and terrible unintended consequences, and then had to go back and get fixed. And as we're talking about defining this and boiling down some issues, I'm thinking rulemaking. So there's a whole other step here to clarify or add confusion. So I think good idea or not it may be, I think we need to really clarify some of these issues, because I'm concerned about the class. I'm concerned about the computer. And, you know, and online we hear a lot about access. Those computers create access. They really do.
Representative Roblin.
Just a quick one on with respect to Representative Van Orman's comments. And for me, if you get too broad on the incentive, the fact that I have at one school 5 AP courses and another school has no AP courses, that's a big incentive for me to move my kids to that school district. Mm-hmm. And I don't want a school district to say, I'm not going to provide these things for my school district because I have to do the same as them, so I don't incentivize people coming here. I don't want to go down that line. I'm more inclined to go down the Representative Huffman's line of saying, what is the issue that's aggrieving? We all agree that people shouldn't be paid to bring their kids to another school. There should not be a direct link between you come to my school and you get something for that no one else would get. But and if we can write that, I feel really comfortable with that, because I agree that is egregious and it shouldn't happen. But when you start getting into incentivizing, a lot of schools do a really great job of providing an education, and everybody would like to go to their kid to be at that school. And that's why some people move, because the schools are in one place are better than the schools in another place. And we shouldn't disincentivize those that are doing a great job by saying, because you're doing that, you're encouraging these people to come to your school. We can't get to that point, because it could be an individual great teacher that everybody in the world, if they knew, if my kid could have that teacher, And there are people out there that they are that good, that anybody that goes through their class seems to blossom later on, because there are exceptional people out there. And I don't want to call that an incentive.
Representative Dimbrough,
thank you.
We're going to have to wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate this conversation, and I think a number of really, interesting potential negative consequences have been raised. It seems to me that at the end of the day, we should be able to distinguish between access to opportunity on the one hand and permanent incentive on the other. And I use the word permanent because I am attracted to the notion of, a permanent incentive versus a loan. I mean, when students are given a computer on loan or books on loan in order for them to be successful in their programs, that's one thing. But if they're given a computer, and especially if this becomes wrapped up in the marketing of the program, if they will have a computer to keep permanently, irrespective of their ongoing enrollment in the program, or that they get to keep their books, where students in regular public schools only receive their books on loan, that's a different thing. And it seems to me that we should be able to distinguish between those two realms and prohibit what we want to prohibit. If this language doesn't get us there, it seems to me it can be worked on to get us there.
Well, and we do have one more person to testify, and what I'd like to suggest is that we continue to work on this over the next week or so, see how we can refine it. One of the recommendations I would have is maybe taking the emergency clause off of it as well, which would give some time for a thoughtful rulemaking process for the further clarifications down the road. One of the concerns that I have in terms of unintended consequences is because this issue has been raised, and that we have now kind of put it out there that it is not illegal to pay cash incentives to individuals to enroll, I think that that it creates a certain level of risk that is out there, and I would like to address that since this has been brewing and bubbling. So with that, Karen Hikes, and to the degree you can be very, very brief, I would be very grateful.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Karen Hikes, Northwest Center for Educational Options. And Madam Chair, you asked me last time I was in this chair, would I support a bill that would prohibit cash incentives to parents for enrolling their students in schools? And I believe my jaw dropped because that was the first I had heard that that could possibly be happening. So let me just be clear that we do not support signing bonuses for students to go to any public school of any kind. And we were concerned about the rumor, and I traced it down to the fairly aggressively and found that there was nothing to the rumor, which is very assuring to me. But the fact that this is actually not illegal is certainly a problem. So we would certainly support making this illegal. I appreciate the conversation you've been having because I think there is the challenge of a school marketing itself. Here are the components of our school. And some of those components in and of themselves incentivize students, as Representative Roblin said, to move, to apply, to lobby, to cajole, do whatever a parent can do to get their kid in that school. That's why we have magnet schools and charter schools and internships and apprenticeships and post-secondary transition programs and all sorts of programs. So how can we ensure that a piece of legislation like this does not interfere with drawing students to customized, unique public education programs? So that would be my only concern. Otherwise, we would fully support the bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not necessarily a question or comment for the whole process. As this is being thought about and perhaps tweaked, we're also considering the distinction between something that is offered to every individual that goes to the school versus selectively cherry-picking an individual, right? An attribute or aspect of attending the school open to whoever comes versus cash incentive to a particular individual or something to really recruit someone away from another school, I think is something we ought to try to work in there, too.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you all very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 135. In a second here, I'm going to pass the gavel over to Representative Dimbro. There are a lot of people in the room. We have a lot of really interesting hearings today. I've already seen some people in the room for the Oregon School for the Blind issue, which is not likely to come up until 11:30 or later. The hearing on religious garb in public schools is also not likely to come up until 10 o'clock. So there are televisions and other things. Don't feel like you have to sit here for all of the hearings, though you're certainly welcome to stay, but just to give you all a timeline so you can plan your day appropriately. So we are going to have a overview and an informational hearing and a public hearing on LC 15. We're going to start with the informational hearing on the online task force report, which is going to be delivered by Senator Devlin, Gary Temple, and myself.
We're all waiting.
All right.
Okay, I'd like to open the information hearing and public hearing on LC 15. And we have a distinguished panel here, as the chair indicated. Three members of the Online Learning Task Force, the two co-chairs, and it's a very capable superintendent of the SIO School District. And choose your order.
Should we do that? What we did yesterday? Would you like to start?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin for the record, Senate District 19. I have a 9-page document that I could read to you from, but rather than to do that, I'm going to give you the first two-thirds of one page. and then just make a few brief comments.
We want to.
There are actually two additional members of the task force here, obviously, Representative Huffman and Representative Dembrow were members of the task force. The task force, as you may obviously recall, came about as part of Senate Bill 767, a bill not without controversy and not without very divisive discussion. We're hoping that that divisive discussion could end here today, because I think that if you look carefully at this bill, you will find that the task force did the job that was assigned to them and did it in a very expeditious manner, given the resources that were given to them of only having five meetings to look at all of these items. The 17 committees, the task force represented a broad array of parties involved in online learning. The task force held five public meetings and took testimony from two national experts, a representative of the State Board of Education, a coalition of school superintendents, members of the statewide education community, and parents and students currently enrolled in virtual schools. Task force members received numerous research papers, curriculum descriptions, a demonstration of online programs and technology, and a large volume of comment provided in writing. LC-15 is designed to address the issues that the task force identified as highest priorities that are practical to address in the short February session. These issues are issues surrounding governance, accountability, quality, funding, and equitable access to online education in Oregon. One of the things that the task force did very early was it took all of the charges that had been given it by the legislature, which were a significant number, and basically divided them into three categories. There might be a little bit of debate what those three categories were, but they were sort of basically what we felt we could address in February, what we felt was better for the State Board of Education to address, and what we actually felt there wasn't sufficient evidence to say that this is an issue that the task force should be addressing at this time, or should be an issue where that we believe that the State Board of Education is going to resolve those issues in a short period of time. I'm going to highlight just a couple of sections in the bill. In Section 1, I won't cite all the subsections, but there are some requirements.
Excuse Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Maurer.
We don't have a copy of the LC draft.
Let me explain to the audience. We have copies of the task force report in the back.
Okay.
And at the back of the report is the LC draft.
Okay.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
And I'll try not to refer to it just by section, because it's more the issues that are involved than actually
just
the wording at this point. You'll get plenty of chance to look at the actual wording.
Right?
It looks like they don't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
I was told that they
but
did.
But I will.
767.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Appropriate. I will just talk
Thank
about
you.
A few of these issues, and that way we'll proceed. The particular area of the bill there actually requires notice between the resident and the sponsoring district. One of the things that we found about online programs, the more we looked at them, was the fact that they are a good option for a number of students. However, a large number of students go through the program and leave the program and don't. I'll give you an example. In Orca's case, in a previous year, about 2,000 students left the program in 1 year's time, with a total enrollment of about 2,500. That does not mean that Orca doesn't have students that are in their second, third, fourth, or even fifth year. It simply means that a lot of students enter the program thinking it's something they would like to do, or that their parents think that they would like to do, but then end up going elsewhere. All that this provision does is keeps the communication there between the resident and the sponsoring district, so that we know where that student is, because we do ultimately have a responsibility to see that they receive an appropriate education. So if they leave the virtual school program, they'll come back obviously to their resident district. They'll either attend a public school, a public charter school, or they'll be homeschooled. But it is important that we know where that student is. We made a promise, both of the co-chairs, when 767 was being considered, that an inadvertent error in how the bill was drafted would be corrected in this measure, and we have done that, actually. The way the measure was constructed, it set the enrollment caps for existing virtual school programs, larger programs, at what their enrollment was May 1st. In Orba's case, its actual waiver existed for another year beyond that, and it was not anywhere close to its capacity at that waiver. What this actually does is allow ORBA to get to its capacity and allows it to remain at that capacity until such time as it receives a future waiver. Also, the two co-chairs of the committee were sitting around looking at all the testimony that we had received, trying to figure out where we would go from here, how we would get agreement on issues about 2 to 3 weeks before we were due to complete the work. And we discovered a problem nobody had ever talked about. And that problem was the way the original bill was constructed, no waiver could have been granted till July 1st of 2011. That would have been very impractical for schools like ORVA and ORCA because they would have had to wait to then until they could have signed any contracts or anything like that. So there's a provision in the bill that allows, in the case of those existing programs, for the State Board of Education to grant a waiver early so that they know what is actually happening at those institutions. The last provision that I would like to highlight is one that I think is very important. And it's actually something where the good co-chair, since she's probably, that's up to the Speaker of the House, just like where I am, it's up to the President of the Senate. But since she's asking herself to be tasked with work and you to be tasked with work, the task force felt very strongly that having the laws for virtual public schools or virtual charter schools, I'll say this very clearly, having the laws for virtual charter schools and the laws for charter schools in the same section of the statute was terribly confusing, led to unintended consequences anytime you discussed one versus the other, and that the committee should very seriously consider in the 2011 session splitting the statute, still having the statute for both, but splitting them so you can talk about one without talking about the other. Because every time we had a discussion, you won't believe the confusion that occurred. Maybe you would believe the confusion occurred. That's basically just a brief summary, and I have not planned to leave this out at all. I think we all owe a debt of gratitude to Ms. Richardson, who staffed the task force very ably, and who actually, I think, has at least 4 or 5 different lives in this building. So.
Thank you, Senator. Rep. Gelser, before you start, let me just say that we are having copies of LC-15 being made. They'll be available soon. But in the meantime, the report, beginning on page 8, does give you a very clear summary of what's in the LC, and to a great extent, it's more comprehensible than the LC itself, as is often the case. Okay. Oh, Superintendent Temple.
Thank you, Representative Dembro. For members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Temple. I'm the superintendent of Scioto School District. We sponsor ORCA, and I was a member of the task force. And as we get started, first let me applaud the two co-chairs. If you would ask me last June if we would come to any agreement in 4 meetings about anything on online education, I would have told you probably not. And they did it masterfully, and you know, and what they did is kept us focused on the things we had accomplished in this session and the things that we needed to look at and accomplish in the next session. And so I applaud them for that. Certainly, you know, online education is huge. We tackled this much of it, and their knowledge in this area is to be commended. My purpose today is to talk about how this is going to affect charter schools. And so I'm going to start by saying there is nothing in this bill that I believe will close or cause a online charter school to close in the near future. And I think it's important to hear that from me. But as we work through this, I'm going to hit some of the highlights. So first, one of the things we were tasked with was how much money does it cost? And there's a lot of disagreement around that. And we heard several things. COSA met and put a small group together to look at the funding part of online education and came back and reported to the task force. And one of the things we realized when we were doing that is it was hard to compare apples and oranges. Charter schools don't report on the same chart of accounts that we do as public schools. It's considered best practice, but not a requirement. And so In my budget that I submit to the state, the amount of money that I give to ORCA is one line item. Shows up as charter school. Where my budget, and you know from your school budgets, you know, that's a 70-page document. And so one of the things we thought needed to happen was if you were to go to Open Books, if you were to go to the Database Initiative, you should see the same information about online education that you would about your regular school district. And so that was one of the recommendations that we made. And that will give us information in the future in which to base decisions on about what the cost of online education is. The other piece is administrators being licensed. I guess I assumed that when we said teachers were to be licensed, that meant kind of the whole staff, and that wasn't the case. So in this case, we've gone one step further, and so we'd like the administrators to be licensed. To my best knowledge, I don't believe that's going to be a problem. All of our administrators are licensed in ORCA. I believe the majority of the administrators are licensed in all the other charter schools. There are about 11 online charter schools now. The notice to the school district, this is one of those areas that I would say we corrected some of the issues that were problematic for school districts that are dealing with online charter schools. And one of those was to know where their kids was. And we went one step farther to say that the information that we wanted them to provide to the districts, which would be contact information, it would be my hope that the districts would reach out to those students and see what kind of educational services they could provide to those students in addition to what, you know, was going on in their charter school and make that relationship. Also notice of disenrollment. When a student, we don't want any situation where a student can fall off the map. And so on disenrollment, we ask that the charter school provide that information to the district. What I do with that is I in turn give that to my administrators who I expect to make a contact with that student to make sure that they've chosen another educational option and that their education is continuing. Transfer of student records and to make sure that is happening, and advertising. This is another area that I think has been problematic. It doesn't matter how much information you put in front of parents. We always need to point out that this is a publicly funded option. That means that there are public requirements, attendance, testing, that kind of stuff. And so making an effort to make sure that is well known, I think, is important. And then waivers. Yeah, I think you heard from Senator Devlin about the importance of starting the waiver process early. We actually will probably start that next November. It's a multi-month process. And we will start the enrollment process in April. So it's going to be important to know that early before that can happen. And then to pass some stuff off to the state board for them to do some research and give us information back on to make decisions. Special ed, governance, funding, participation, and how that looks. And finally, I'll say it again, nothing in this bill do I believe will close a charter school or cause it to close in the near future. So with that, I will turn it over.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, House District 16, and I had the opportunity to serve on the online task force with these two fine folks and a lot of other people. I think, like the two who have spoken before me, as I looked ahead at the task of the online learning task force, particularly knowing that we had originally only 4 meetings allocated to us, I was apprehensive and anxious would be understatements about our ability to come forward and deliver something. Our goal was really to try to focus down and bring down the level of discord and animosity in this debate and try to find the places where there is common ground between all of the advocates in this process, whatever their point of view may have been during Senate Bill 767. And we found that, like most things, there was a whole lot of common ground. The first was, I think everyone involved in the process was very concerned that all students have access to a free and appropriate public education and that public education be adequately funded.
I think that there was a uniform concern that when we have online charter schools that they be of the highest quality, because that goes to that first value of making sure that students have access to a high quality, free and appropriate, adequately funded public education. And when we began to focus on those pieces, it was easier to start to address some of the issues that we've brought before you today. It would be not accurate to say that we accomplished everything that everyone on the task force or everyone in the community would have liked us to. I think what we are bringing to you in LC15 is the point that we could get to with consensus, and it did not make sense in February to try to push through anything additional. We needed more time and more thought. By sending some of this back to the Department of Education with a very clear timeline, September 1st, and we're proposing to appropriate the appropriate resources for them to do this work, to come back to us on September 1st. It's going to keep everyone at the table. It will keep the process moving, and it will allow the legislature and the advocates to remain in constant dialogue with the Department of Education. It also means that when we get to December, hopefully we'll have proposed legislation for January, and it won't be something that we're surprised and looking at further into the session. So I hope that we can continue the collaborative spirit that we have started to develop through the work of this online task force. One of the things that several members of the task force did, I was one of them, was take the opportunity to visit some students who were participating in online learning programs. I had the opportunity to go out and visit SIO and visit with staff and kind of get a better hands-on idea of exactly how the technology works, how the platforms work. I found that to be very helpful because this committee is going to be moving forward and working on this next session. I would suggest if you have time to do a couple of those things during your interim, because you know you'll all be busy when we get back into session. It's worthwhile, and it's always fun to get out there and talk to kids. So with that, I would just again thank my colleagues. I hope that we can move this forward. One of the process issues that's different about this legislative concept than all of the other legislative concepts that we have is that Senate Bill 767 said that into the February session would be introduced the legislative concept that was forwarded by the Online Learning Task Force. So in the previous LC that we were talking about, obviously we're going to go back and make some tweaks and put them in. Because we are putting this in at the request of the Online Learning Task Force, we really need to introduce it in the way that it came. We were pleased to have overwhelming support for the concept. There were some concerns that were raised, and one of those had to do with the administrator credentialing process and what would the process be for a current administrator who is not yet licensed. Would they immediately lose their position? How hard is it to get that license? And we have TSPC here today to talk a little bit about what that process would look like. But I'm hopeful that this is something that you can all support so that we can continue moving forward in this discussion. And we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, panel. Let me just say before I turn to my colleague, Representative Huffman, that my own hope for the task force was that if we were to bring together a good group of people, we could make some real progress on this issue and have good conversation in the beginning of a really forward-looking investigation of the role of online education in our public school system. And I think we did do that, and it was thanks to the people who were on the task force and the leadership of the two co-chairs. It really was an open discussion, a thoughtful discussion. I would echo Senator Devlin and say, I wish we had more time and more resources because this was just the beginning of a conversation that really needs to happen. So I'll turn to my dear colleague, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say that, most people in this room probably can't imagine the amount of work that Representative Gelser, Senator Devlin, and Dana put into LC-15. Hours and hours and hours of work outside of the task force meetings, and I really appreciate all that work, and there's a lot of good stuff in LC-15. I do have one question, and then, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can save my comments till the end, or I can give them now.
Sure.
Regarding LC-15. It's totally up to you.
Why don't you give us your overall perspective and then go into questions, Representative?
Okay, so save the question till last. Okay. The concerns I had with LC-15, it was broadly acknowledged that we should probably be looking at changing the governance model or separating out and having one set of rules for charter schools and another set of rules for virtual schools. And I think maybe Senator Devlin acknowledged, I believe you mentioned something about we had looked at that and acknowledged that we probably need to look toward doing something like that. However, we haven't done that yet. And based on the fact that virtual schools are governed under charter school rules now, I was concerned that we are requiring an LC-15 for superintendents and assistant superintendents to be certified by TSPC. And in charter schools, under charter school rules, the superintendent or the administrators are not required to be certified by TSPC. So it concerned me that we were taking some charter school rules and not others. And so that concerned me. There's another aspect in there where I'm afraid that we're restricting the Board of Education's ability to grant a waiver based on good cause. We're restricting the board, I think, maybe a little too much. ORBA has a situation where they're licensed to do K through 8, and it may or may not be a situation. I wanted to see something in LC-15 that kind of alleviated any concern down the road. If we have, I forget now, say 100 eighth graders graduating from ORVA, and ORVA doesn't do high school, and there's no provision in LC-15 to allow them to come and apply to do high school or give them some means of being able to continue that eighth grader. And let's say ORCA's at their cap of 2,600 or some whatever that magic number is. They're capped out inside K-12. They're all maxed out. We've got X number of eighth graders graduating from ORVA that if they wanted to continue an online virtual education, they couldn't. There wouldn't be any place for them to go, and that concerns me. One other aspect was in the transparency portion of it. Mr. Temple pointed out, and I agree, that there were some best practices, but there are models of bookkeeping, if you will, and the transparency surrounding those. And that's a great part of LC-15, that all educational providers report the same way, and it's transparent. However, we're going a step beyond that and requiring in LC-15 that online virtual providers disclose their profit margins. So it goes beyond some of their expenses of providing the education, but we're actually requiring them to divulge, proprietary information. And Senator Morris pointed out that that was a concern that he had also. So that, I'll shut up now, but that kind of wraps up my concerns. I don't think any of them are insurmountable. However, that does bring me then to the question of, in your opinion, or maybe we should get Cindy to answer it in a legal manner, but based on Senate Bill 767 or House rules or Senate rules, are we required to submit to the legislature LC-15 in the form exactly adopted by the task force, or is there a legal way to adopt some minor changes?
Representative Dimbro, may I?
Yes, please.
And I can share with you my understanding of the way that this works. Senate Bill 767 required that a task force meet and that legislation be introduced that was at the recommendation of the task force. LC-15 is what the task force recommended. So I think it would be very difficult for us to change it make it a different bill and put it forward. There are a couple things. First, the profit margin piece was actually part of 767. That's not something new that is in LC15. So that is existing. And in terms of the 9 through 12 for ORVA, and that's something that there's been a lot of discussion about, this is just my opinion and my perspective on this, and that is that this year, last year, the year before that year, ORVA was a K-8 school. So the students who are 8th graders this year are in no different circumstance than the students who were in 8th grade last year or the year before that. Because Senate Bill 7, because LC-15 does move forward that ability to go ahead and apply for the waiver, there is that ability in going for that waiver for next school year, for that school year that would begin July 1st, 2011, to work with the State Board to grant that extension. However, part of the terms of 767, if you remember, was putting kind of a timeout on growth and a timeout on waivers. ORVA, in very large part, has been exempted from that because they continue to grow by a couple of hundred students this year, and we have language in this bill to protect that growth moving forward. So, in effect, the consequence, and I don't want to minimize the consequence for those 8th graders that would, I'm not philosophically opposed to ORVA going to adding 912 to what they're doing. I just think that trying to add that in at this point where you have a bill that had such broad consensus could slow the bill down and in a February session that moves really quickly risk the entire bill. And as I weigh the benefit of exempting ORVA again from the requirements of 767 by granting a waiver authority that would be available only to one school and not to others versus the consequence of losing the protection for those couple hundred kids that enrolled in ORVA this year that is in LC-15 and the protection to all of the virtual online kids of being sure that they're able to get their waiver in time to continue in the 2011-2012 school year, I think that it is more important to put the eggs in that basket. LC-15 is not perfect, and as I had said, there are people that think it goes too far. There's people that think it doesn't go far enough. I think what it represents are the places where we can get to consensus and the places where the senator and I, talking to a lot of folks, feel like we can reasonably move this bill through the process and pass it. You might remember last session, there was a little bit of controversy over this issue, and it's the type of issue where you move a little bit one direction, you're losing ground because there is such division. This kind of seems to be that sweet spot that moves the ball forward, protects some kids, and gets us into that next place.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Senator, did you have any comments?
The only thing to keep in mind, and I think Chair Gelser did a very good job of this, is that the circumstance that ORVA faces with 8th graders is a circumstance that they have faced for a number of years. The only children that are going to be impacted by the fact that they don't have a waiver that gets them to the 9th grade at ORVA is this will be the final year. Next year's 8th graders, if they get another waiver, and the waiver includes 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, they'll be able to go on to ORVA. We actually thought that the issue of waivers should be left up to the Board of Education. So, I mean, it's their determination on whether the waiver should be granted, how many grades it should be granted on. You will notice, actually, very carefully that in crafting this legislation, we attempted not to basically side with one side or the other on a lot of issues. ORVA has a circumstance in their waiver that says that they need the approval of the sponsoring district or of the resident district. We did not put that into this statute, that's a requirement in the future for waivers, that you have to have the approval of the resident district. That issue we've left up to the board. There are lots of people that wanted us to side on one side or the other of that. We chose not to, actually, because we were trying to find something to advance some of the work that needs to be done here where we could get agreement in this February session. I think, to me, one of the most important aspects of this bill, because I highlighted it first, is knowing where the kids are. Because there's a vast number of kids that enter these programs that actually some of them succeed, but many of them enter, go back to other programs. And we do have a responsibility to those children also to see that they're getting an appropriate education. I think there are many good aspects of this bill. You know, I've been in this building a fairly long time, maybe. Maybe in some people's minds too long, but but actually, I usually don't get everything I want in a piece of legislation. I usually have to compromise, and I've never considered compromise to be a bad way to approach trying to get agreement. So,
okay. Thank you, Senator. Representative Huffman has a follow-up, and then Rep. Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up. Senator, on the Orva eighth graders, am I incorrect in my thinking? You had said that nothing's really changed, that, you know, when the eighth graders graduated at Orva, then that was it. There was never another option. But we didn't have the caps on Orca and others in place prior to this current school year. So my point was that if the other virtual providers are capped out, then there's no option for the eighth graders. Prior to this year, they did have an option because Orca, for example, didn't have a cap, and they could take that eighth grader in.
Well, prior to the adoption of 767, a waiver had been granted to Orva that was superseded by the statute. That waiver had a cap within it. So even without 767, there would have been a cap on Orca. The State Board of Education had put a cap, I believe, of 2,800 students.
And can you speak a little bit to the...
So, Vice Chair Dembrough, Representative Huffman, member of the committee, currently our cap is 2,574, is the magic number from May 1st. We are not at our cap. We were about 100 under, been about 100 under all year, and there were two other online schools added this year, part of the all-prep system. So there is some room. I'm not going to be able to tell you that there's 100 spots in ninth grade, but there is some room still left in the system, so we're not all quite at our cap yet.
Thank you, Mr. Rep. Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with all, just a comment, then a question. With all due respect to the work that the task force did, I think that if there are some things that we as a legislative lawmaking body see that need to be changed, I think it would behoove us to do that. Having said that, I'm not real clear on the caps. Were there recommendations? Are there recommendations in LC 15 to lift the enrollment caps? Was there evidence brought forward that indicates that those need to remain in place? I'm not real clear about what's happening with the caps.
Do you want to go first?
Well, if I could go first just for a moment, yep. Because I have Senator Courtney is calling. is that there's no recommendations about the continuation of the caps within this. That issue was actually left to the Board of Education. You'll note in this that they still have the ability. There's nothing in this bill that would prohibit them from waiving the 50% requirement, which they have done in the past. There's nothing in LC 15 preventing them from doing that. But actually, that issue was left to the Board of Education, and because I think that's where the task force felt it was best left. I would say also that there were three issues that were referred back to the Board of Education, the first one being because they had a very strong interest in looking at different governance structures for virtual education, and they wanted the opportunity to present one to the legislature so that that's actually in the bill, that they present one to the 2011 legislature. The two others were issues around funding and issues around services to children with special needs. We're expecting reports back on those. Those are very complex issues. I'm not expecting those to be resolved anytime in the near future. So,
and I think that I would build on that. The issue of the caps, whether it was to lift the caps altogether or permanently, I think you had people who would advocate lifting them forever and people that would advocate never being able to waive them. That was one of those issues where we were not going to come to consensus.
Can I clarify?
Yeah.
Okay, I think there's two different caps. There's kind of the 50% rule cap, mm-hmm. that was put in place in 2005, and then this last session we put a cap
We did a kind of timeout, as was mentioned.
Okay, so I guess the timeout cap, that's what I'm referring to. Was there any discussion about lifting that?
There was no discussion about lifting that cap because, remember, this work is continuing and is going to come back on September 1st. So this idea of if we're going to create a governance system that makes more sense, the longer things grow and we're granting all different kinds of waivers, so even different virtual schools are operating under different rules. Great example. If you want to enroll your child at ORCA, you can just enroll your child at ORCA. You don't have to go and get sign-off from your local school district. If you want to enroll your child at ORVA, you have to go get sign-off from your local school district. If you remember Senate Bill 767, I think we ended up with something like 1,000 amendments. And the reason that we had that, and that was a real eye-opener for me to work on that, because the goal was simply to say, we want to keep kids in school. We don't want to displace anyone. Because the rules are so different depending on each school, it became very difficult to write that in the law. So there was not a discussion about lifting that time out while we continue this work, because the longer it continues to go with different rules for everyone, the more complicated it becomes to create a governance system where everybody is playing on the same field. That said, as Mr. Temple just indicated, I mean, we've got schools that aren't at their cap, so we're not turning kids away. The second piece is on the issue of the, I've got two more things, on the issue of the overall cap. Generally, the 50% rule. One of the reasons that I thought it was smarter for this task force not to address it, besides the fact that it probably would have been impossible to reach consensus, is that if we really are looking at creating a governance model that makes sense, that question may go away altogether. We might start looking at this in a wholly different way. And that actually is my hope. On the third piece, I want to make clear there's a distinction between the legislature making changes and introducing. So when I talked about making changes, we can adjust the LC before we turn it into a bill. So we need to introduce LC so it's introduced in a bill in the form of LC 15. Of course, once it enters the process, it's like any other bill in the process and the legislature can make changes. The challenge that we will have as a committee is managing that process, given that we get 4 2-hour meetings in which to do all of our hearings and pass all of our bills out, or else the clock strikes 12 and all the bills turn into pumpkins that haven't left. And that's going to be my concern, is making sure that whatever we do, we're able to get this bill through, because I think the chart of accounts, I think the ORVA fix for the kids that enrolled this year, and I think the fix to make sure that the schools can be applying for their waivers before July 1st of next year are really important to preserving kids.
Thank you, Representative. I think we're going to lose the senator, but we have a few more questions.
I wanted to thank you for this opportunity, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you.
I have to go back.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair. My question is, did you get information about schools in the public system that are offering online courses, such as Salem Kaiser offers SK Online? We have many students that take high school students and even probably middle school students that take college courses from different universities online. Did you get any fact-finding to see how many students are learning online?
We did, and one of the things that we did early on in the task force was to invite all of the different programs that were offering online instruction, including the virtual online public charter schools, but also the public school, mm-hmm. traditional public school-based programs, to come and do kind of a demo. So committee members were able over a lunch hour to go up, look at the different platforms. People brought the scope and sequence of their curriculum. You could, kind of get online and see what it looked like. One of the other things that we did that's kind of subtle in this bill is we expanded the relating clause, and if you look at that charge to the Department of to the Oregon Department of Education, it's really not just about governance for online public charter schools. It's about how do we use this tool of virtual learning and online education generally. So Representative Huffman mentioned the idea of, if you're in a rural area and you want to offer an advanced math class, right, or Mandarin, how do we make sure that those students have access to that? can a school district contract with a virtual online school to provide all of their seventh grade math? How do these things go together? And we're asking the state board to look at that information as well. What was clear as we went through this is that there's a lot of opportunity through the online learning modality, and a lot of the evidence is really pointing towards some of these hybrid models where you're a brick-and-mortar school, but you're using these tools. And I think that's one of those places where you're learning something in a laboratory in a charter school, you're seeing what's working, and then you're bringing it back into your traditional public schools as well.
Thank you. Great. Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Again, I want to thank the group for doing this. It's been a passion of mine for a while, and I continue to feel better late than never. We should have been here 5 or 10 years ago and anticipated what was going to happen and then put the stuff in place, as opposed to trying to figure out while the car is running. And that's really the technology right now. We're out there doing it at a time when we don't really know what we're doing, and therefore now we're trying to figure out how to get the policies to match with it. And we're finally having a conversation that respects both sides. I think this was a start for that. I think there has been not a respect in both in this area for a while, and I'm pleased to see what happened. And for that purpose and that reason alone, because I think there's little things that I could probably tweak in this one too, I've come to the conclusion that it's more than likely for me that LC-15 needs to stay pretty intact, just because I think people did come to the table respectfully to start having the conversation we should have had a number of years ago. We need to continue it. I think we really need to continue it. I'm hopeful because the one group is in my district, and I don't want to see those kids hurt. I am taking it on people's words who I've come to trust that there will be places for people, and I understand that one with Representative Huffman in this particular time. And I've checked around to see if there are avenues for people to have places. I think there are, but it is from my perspective the idea that people are actually coming together to have a real conversation about a bigger issue, and that is virtual education. And it's not just about charter schools. I've always felt there needs to be another place to have this conversation. I'm pleased that you came to some of the same conclusions. And there's one part of this bill that truthfully was where I thought you were only going to get, and so I'm really pleased where you got, and that is on page 3, line number 25, when you finally had to decide and come together on the definition of biweekly. to me, that's the kind of thing I was afraid was going to happen in this committee, that you would get the agreements on biweekly means twice a week, but you wouldn't get anyplace else, and I think you have moved. There's places that I probably wouldn't have gone or I would have done differently, but the reality is we are in the state having a conversation about something that is very important for kids, and my goal wants to go back to we need to be about the children who are being educated in Oregon and how do we get them the best opportunity to get to reach their potential. And it has less to do with all the different companies that are in the deal and all the different school districts that are in this whole issue. How do we get there? And for me, this is the beginning of that conversation, and we have a long way to go. But it started, and you got passed biweekly, twice a week. It is, to see the three of you sitting up there was also nice from my perspective. We've had a lot of conversations over the time, and I appreciate that people came to the table to talk and to try to figure something out. And I have never seen any issue that when it's contentious, everybody is really happy at the very end that it's perfect. And I appreciate you acknowledging right off the bat, not perfect, but it's where we are right now. So I want to thank the other two people from this committee who were on that committee that did this work. We have a lot of work left to do, but it's a good start.
Thank you, Representative. And I don't know if a response is required, but I think your comments really provide an excellent summary for this, or closing for this discussion. And then we can move on. Okay.
Thank you. And thank you. Tremendous thanks to everyone that served on the task force, and of course, again, to Dana and to the staff and Senator Devlin in my office, both Chris and Autumn, and everybody did so much work. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Vicki Chamberlain is going to come up and talk about some of the sort of logistics of the administrator certification.
Vice Chair Dembro, Chair Gelser, members of the committee for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, and until I heard your conversation the last 45 minutes, I wasn't precisely clear what you wanted. just assuming your language stays the way it is, and what's required for administrators, what distinguishes administrators? Let me start from the beginning. Your charter schools right now require that at least half of the teachers and administrators are licensed by TSPC. The other half are registered. And through registration, we do background checks. We do not do qualification checks. It is up to the charter school and the district to determine whether someone's highly qualified or otherwise. We don't do resume checks for registering an administrator or anything further. We're not authorized, frankly, to look at qualifications of registration other than a bachelor's degree. And but what the registration also does is it brings those people into the professional conduct area so that if there's misconduct, that would be the same as if they were licensed, they would be treated equally. And I think that's probably the best I could do to describe the differences between registration and licensure. What's required for administrators, in a nutshell, is that they have a master's degree, which they can obtain by completing an administrator preparation program. What distinguishes them from teacher preparation is they have preparation in policy, they have to know school law, they have to know school finance, they focus on policy vision, instructional leadership. It's a different set of academics as compared to delivering instruction, which teachers get. In Oregon, to become an initial administrator, it's really quite simple. We ask for 3 years on a license. That does not mean they have to be 3 years as a teacher. So someone can complete an administrator preparation program. We have an alternative certification they can obtain called a restricted administrator's license, which they can work in a charter school or an online school as an administrator on this license if they have a master's degree, complete their program, and then obtain full unrestricted licensure. Restricted means they're restricted to working in that place. We have an emergency administrator's license, which is if a district has an emergency and they need a license, it's generally granted for a year. It's a transition license. And it's often for people to complete requirements, or it's to allow a district to find a new leader or to transition. And then we also have a license for administrators that's unique called the exemplary license. And if someone has a master's degree and a great deal of experience in management and running businesses and things like that, and a school district wants to hire them, they can petition the commission for this license. There's three of them out there in the state. They may use this license. And I don't know if any of you knew Gretchen Schutte, but this was, for example, a license that she had when she went from Mount Hood Community College to Gresham. So I'm doing this, trying to do a little light speed thing here for you, because I know you're in a hurry. So
I think Representative Huffman has a pressing question.
Okay. Just a quick question. Might give you a little direction. I was curious, does TSPC have a definition for, like, principal, administrator, superintendent? Do you have, like, job descriptions or definitions that tell you what role they play in a school district requires
no.
a certain...
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, we do not, but we're talking about it. And actually, I don't think it's a definition so much as what are the scope of the duties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the issue we're struggling with. When should someone have an administrator license? And right now it's pretty much if they evaluate licensed staff, they should have an administrator license because they're holding that person's job in their hand.
Are you in the process of putting that in rule?
Yes, we're having a conversation with them. In fact, I have a meeting with the COSA folks this Friday. I mean, it really, just like our international license, everything, the universe conspires to come together. The conversation is on the table, and we're actively engaged in it. But fundamentally, we want to distinguish when absolutely should they be completing an administrator preparation program, what are their duties that they're going to be doing, and when human resource officers are a great example of someone we don't require licensure from. Business managers we wouldn't require. But somebody who is engaging with students and engaging with licensed teachers and representing the school district, spending and being accountable for public funds, we think all fall in the definition of when they ought to be licensed. But, just generally. Is that helpful?
Representative Mallory. Actually, there's a contradiction. A business manager doesn't, but anybody that spends public funds is.
Well, the business manager usually is directly accountable to the assistant superintendent or the superintendent and the HR person, but we're just talking about whoever is responsible for the budget, the distribution, the program.
Which I thought.
Okay. It depends on the district.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions for Ms. Chamberlain? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki, I apologize because I didn't get this to you ahead of time, and I hope you can at least give us a sense for this. In online charter schools, do you have a sense? I'd love a number, but do you have a sense of how many? Because, let me back up. It's my understanding from prior charter school experience that they at least have to be registered, correct? You talked about that. So then, of those online schools, how many of those administrators, a sense of that, are registered?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, I have no idea, to be perfectly honest. I did talk to Karen, who actually has usually a pretty great idea, and she believes everyone is currently licensed in the current online schools, but I would have to go and personally check.
I should have asked Karen.
That's
thank
all
you.
Well, you'll have a chance in a minute. Are there any further questions for Ms. Chamberlain?
Just one. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we talked earlier about potentially a process would be set up to allow administrators to transition into a licensed status. Do you see that happening under the emergency license kind of process, or do you see another kind of process? How would that work?
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Dembro, as always, when new policy is adapted, we look at our rules, and I don't think the rules precisely accommodate what you're envisioning right now, and we would have to take a look at that. I think it's a very easy fix, frankly, but it's just given what we've known today, are the rules fit, and I don't think it's a perfect fix right now, and we would make something work. And so it doesn't make sense not to.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
All right. And I'm going to call our other three folks up in one single panel, Lori Wimmer, Karen Hykus, and Todd Thorpe. And I know there's a lot to say, but we're now running about 15 minutes behind. So as brief as you can be would be most helpful.
Right.
Thank you.
Again, for the record, Madam Chair and committee members, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association, its 47,000 members, on this non-controversial housekeeping measure. We have been working on this since 2005, and this issue in one form or another. And we wanted to say, for your record, first of all, that we do support passage of LC-15 as introduced. And we also want to echo the comments of others, thanking the co-chairs of the task force for their Herculean efforts. And they did a masterful job of bringing us all together in a meaningful way to talk about all the very complex and arduous aspects of this issue. We have frequently been misunderstood for our perspective on it. We know that technology in the classroom is essential for learning. It helps with differentiation and so on. And there are a number of students, I would say the majority, who want to be able to take a class here or there, not the entire school program. They would see it as a tool, not a school. Ours has always been a matter of wanting to make sure that students and their families as consumers have access to quality, and to make sure that as we manage an entire public education system, that the finances, the regulation, and so on are done in a way that students, no matter how they choose to get their public education accessed, have an equal shot at it. No one set of kids should be advantaged in a way that disadvantages others, particularly with respect to finances. But having said that, we believe that this measure, though it didn't address all of the concerns and issues we would like to see, did a terrific job of getting to the heart of the matter. And we know that there'll be continued work on this topic, and we'll look forward to working with the State Board to further refine online education policy for the state. Some of the things that we think are still on the table are the structure and governance issues that enable people to access online learning in a variety of ways and a variety of venues. They can do that now. It's not just the charter school model that is that offers this or that provides this service, so that there are students who are able to access, for example, the Salem-Keizer Public Schools have SK Online, and students outside of the district can access that. So there are other models out there at this moment that we hope will be preserved and that do offer a quality option all the way through. And so we know that it's a matter of figuring out how to take the different approaches and find a way to have a singular way to look at online learning that's as easy and expeditious for the State Board and the Department of Education to do their regulatory due diligence, as well as for the limited resources we have for public education in general to be spread among all the different ways to learn. Did we get everything we wanted? No. There are issues around access that we think are still on the table, and we're hopeful that the State Board will take direction not only to look at the special education access issues, but also English language learners and students from low-income households, and how they, particularly at the elementary level, you can't leave the student home alone when the parent is at work. How do they then access this tool? We also believe that there are finance issues that still are on the table to learn, but we're happy that there's a validation of assessment in the bill, that that we're going farther than just the charter school model in how the regulations will be looked at, and that the alignment of accounting functions with the objects and functions is now all consistent, so we can compare apples to apples. We think it's a good compromise, and we thank you very much for all your hard work and look forward to being a partner as we move forward to continue to refine.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hikas.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Karen Hikas, Northwest Center for Educational Options. As Lori and many others in this room, we have also been at the table and involved in these conversations for 4 or 5 years. It's 2010, so I guess 5 years. We appreciate very much the work of the online task force, and we understand how daunting it was in the long list of issues that the task force was tasked to address. And we appreciate the approach of finding the consensus issues and moving forward. And as a former high school English teacher, I have to say we've been involved in every chapter of this story, and we hope that the climax of the plot is behind us and that we are now on the way to plot resolution. We are optimistic that that is the case. Our organization and our membership will support any policy, any good policy that will improve the quality of public education in our state for our students, particularly charter school students, because that's our mission. We want high quality public charter schools, and certainly agree with the confusion around, you know, the virtual charter schools and the regular charter schools, and there are certainly bigger fish to fry from our perspective for charter schools broadly, and kind of the policy conversation for charters has been hijacked by this online piece. So we're looking forward to that being resolved. Certainly would support the separation or having maybe a subsection of the charter law devoted to virtual charter schools. Our concern would be preserving some choice in there for parents. But ultimately, we would love to see a virtual public school system, K-12, for our state that includes the whole spectrum. Students in a traditional brick and mortar who want to take an online course, whether it's because they're remote or because they don't offer it in their school or whatever the reason, all the way, you know, including hybrid, all the way over to full-time distance learning, whatever that looks like. We would like to see a system and common standards and protocols that include and apply to all of those, and funding for all of those. If a student is in an online school, whether it's a charter through a district or an ESD or community college, shouldn't it be the same funding? So we're looking forward to continuing to create that system. We do support LC-15, we didn't get everything we wanted, but I do need to say I'm glad that some of the things we feared would be in there are not in there, so we're grateful for that. We appreciate the fiscal piece and having the the accounting line up with state standards. We think that creates more transparency. We certainly would support that because we've seen some one-line item budgets, and you can't tell where the money's going, and that's not okay. So we definitely support that. Certainly support most of the other provisions of the bill. We appreciate also that there are some built-in deadlines in this concept for the state board to act by September to make recommendations to you, for you to act next session, and if you don't, then the state board could start issuing waivers again if they chose, and so there's that built-in piece that hopefully we will have some resolution within the next year, year and a half. We appreciate that. As always, we remain at the table with everybody, whether they're speaking to us or not. Sorry. We are here. We will find the common ground and move forward. Thank you for the opportunity to be involved.
Thank you. And I must say how nice it is to have a discussion about virtual online schools in which we can all laugh.
That's true.
This is good. This is good. Mr. Tharp.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Todd Thorpe. I'm the head of school at the Oregon Virtual Academy, which is located in North Bend, Oregon, sponsored by North Bend School District. We are a statewide virtual public school and currently offer this opportunity to kindergarten through eighth grade students, approximately about 530 as of today. I also appreciate all the effort that was put into the task force. I attended many of the hearings and read all the notes, and it was a daunting to-do list, and many, many good things came of it. I'm here today to just speak about three items and can be fairly brief. Senator Devlin spoke about the first two. The first one, Section 5.2b, which is sort of the ORVA fix, which allows our students to continue enrollment. That's the cap fix. That affects, just so you're aware, 48% of our current student population. So on behalf of those parents, thank you for that to the task force, and I urge the committee to keep that in the bill because, again, that affects approximately 48% of our student population. The second piece is allowing the State Board of Education to start reviewing waivers and then grant waivers with an effective date of July 1st. Since we've started, our families and students have always had this anxiety about how long are we going to stay open. There's always this deadline of when our charter is up for renewal. And then with the passage of Senate Bill 767, which superseded our two-year renewal, we kind of kicked into this space of unknown, and now with LC-15, we're guaranteed another year. But we still have this anxiety and this unknown. What's the State Board of Education going to do when we ask for our renewal as of July 1st, 2011? So our families continue to be in a state of anxiety and unknown with what they want to do. Third thing that I want to discuss and ask, and it's already been brought up today, is the ability to put in a fix that would allow us to offer ninth grade. Not an increase to our cap, but allow us to serve our ninth grade students. Operationally at the school level, we're all set. We can provide this. Our families would like it. We currently, there was some question about how many eighth grade families we have. We have 80 currently. I understand that there's been conversation that we've never offered high school, so our families should be aware of this. Well, originally when we received our waiver from the State Board of Education, we had asked for grades K through 12. They provided the waiver only grades K through 8. That was a two-year waiver that was set to sunset this June 30th. So we knew that as of July 1st this year, we had the opportunity to renew our waiver, ask for grades 9 through 12. We've always messaged that to our family. That's our hope. That's our goal. With the passage of Senate Bill 767 that superseded the waiver, that no longer allows us to be currently in a waiver process and allowing us to potentially offer grades 9 for the 2010-11 school year. So there is this added year of unknown, and then there's the additional unknown that the State Board of Education may not allow us to offer high school grades when they go through this renewal process. So it is true that the eighth graders in the first year knew there was going to be no high school this current year. However, our seventh grade students enrolled during 2008-2009 knew that there was a chance and opportunity that we would offer high school grades for the 2010-11 school year. That's always been our plan. Our charter agreement with the North Bend School District is for grades K through 12. It's a five-year agreement that sunsets in 2012. So the initial intent of our charter agreement, the intent of the North Bend School District Board, and of ORV has always been to offer high school. So my ask to the committee is if there is any way to just allow us to offer ninth grade, not an increase to the cap, our families would greatly appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to urge, if it's a very quick question, we're really far behind.
Quick question for you, Madam Chair. Is that possible for the committee to do that?
I think it is possible. I think that it changes the trajectory for the consensus that's been built, and it would create a new precedent for putting in statute what has been done previously by the state board. I mean, the legislature has never put in statute what grades people offer. That's been something that's gone through a waiver process, not through legislation. So I think that if we were consistent with practice, the best that could be done would be to kick it to the state board, but that would require lifting the moratorium and the timeout, and I would guess we might start hearing from other virtual online schools about why does one school get exempted from the timeout while others do not. So anything's possible. I just think that it moves the discussion beyond the consensus that was reached over the last several months. Is there any further comment, discussion? No, seeing none, thank you all very much, and I will close the public hearing on Legislative Concept 15 and the informational meeting on the report from the online task force. And we are just a few minutes behind. I know we were planning to start Religious Garb right at 10. We've got one more quick hearing that we need to do, so it's probably going to be about 10:10 before we get to that point, but we are getting to you. I know a couple of more people I've seen come in and out for the School for the Blind hearing. That is not going to happen until at least 11:30 probably. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3619. Representative Kahn.
Thank you. If Dana wants to give an overview, and I'm going to go down to
Perfect.
The table.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3619 would establish a task force on career preparation and development that would be tasked with improving the effectiveness of education professionals by building stronger connections between institutions of preparation and employers of education professionals. It provides for the task force membership, which would be appointed by the chancellor, and it requires the task force to submit findings and a system proposal to our interim education committees no later than December 2nd, 2010. The Oregon University System would staff the task force, and it would be disbanded at the beginning of the next regular session, and there's lots of good stuff in there that Rep. Kampf will probably tell us about.
Thank you. And can we invite Dean Hicks to join
us? Yes, Mr. Hicks. Hicks. Not, sorry.
Well, good morning, and thank you for welcoming us. And my name for the record is Betty Kampf. I serve House District 22. And House Bill 3619 LC Draft 177. We've been working on this for a little bit of time. There's been a group that was formulated already previously, and let me join in, and we drafted this legislation. What our staff is handing to you is some suggested revisions that we are looking at, and I'll get to those in just a minute. But to share with who we've had at the table discussing teacher preparation, administrative preparation, and counselor preparation is people from the Chancellor's Office, OEA, deans from private and public universities, and TSPC. And like I say, they let me join in a little bit. And this group has been in a very dynamic discussion about our teacher preparation programs. You will hear in the news relatively soon, possibly even tomorrow, that our teacher preparation programs in Oregon through a national survey, you know how all those are, will not be at the top of the list. And I will wait for you to read the press to find out where we're at, but it's not where we'd like to be seen throughout our country. And so knowing that there's variables that are being put in place by the federal government that gives guidelines and these such things. There's been much work being done by the universities, by TSP, in this area already. We want to definitely, as part of this process, help you know what some of those things are. Dean Hitz will maybe share a few of those this morning. But what this bill does is formalize the work that we're doing and lets the legislature know that if there will be any fiscal ramifications, we'll have that available and what we're trying to accomplish. We sincerely believe, and I've had the privilege of being a school administrator and observing phenomenal teachers in our system. But we want to continue having phenomenal teachers for our students. And we want to make sure that they have all the support that we can give every learning classroom and administrators and counselors the best supports possible. Many of us know that many beginning teachers literally drop out after a few years. That's how come we started our mentor program, and we fund that. And so this gives a deeper analysis to some of those steps. The original draft that we drafted had some real concrete outline for the committee to work with on that, and much like what was just stated about the online learning, sometimes that specificity is hard to really get to. We wanted to create a little more flexibility in what we want to accomplish, because we may find out information in our research process that will drive us in a little different direction. So we didn't want to be absolutely tied to only the aspects that are written in the bill draft. And the other part that is important, the Chancellor's Office and some other agency folks have been helping pay for the staffing for this and private partnerships. And so they have committed to continue to assist in that way. And it is my honor to introduce Dean Hitz, and he is an absolute leader in this field, and I will not, it's my honor to pass the microphone to him.
Okay. Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Randy Hitz. I'm Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University, and I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 3619, LC-177. The wisdom of this legislation, by the way, you have my written testimony, so I'm not going to go over that in detail because I know you're short of time, but the wisdom of this legislation is it builds on a lot of great work that's going on in the state already. Representative Comp referred to the Coalition for Quality Teaching and Learning, which she's part of, but it also builds on the good work of the State Board of Education, Board of Higher Education, TSPC, and the Chalkboard Project, all of which are really looking at, in their own areas, looking at standards for teachers, for teacher education, professional development, so on. What's missing? And the reason this is important is that we don't have a good, comprehensive, seamless system for professional preparation and ongoing professional development of teachers and school administrators. That's what's missing, and that's what this is all about. And by the way, when Representative Comp referred to the national survey that's going to come out in the next couple days, that's really about the system. And teacher education is a piece of that, but it's about the system, and Oregon's system is seen wanting, according to Education Week. We can take issues with that, but that's what this is about. And so I think there's a great opportunity here to build on the good work of Oregon. There is a lot of good things, good things going on. And to build on the work and of that new coalition that's been established and supported, by the way, through a public-private partnership, because Chalkboard has been providing staffing for that effort. And you'll see in my recommendations that that's also built in, that we maintain and support that public-private partnership in this effort. So again, thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Any brief questions?
No.
Nope, seeing none. Thank you both very much. Vicki Chamberlain, is she in the hall?
She said she really didn't need to testify.
And she's agreeing with you in the back.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Okay, thank you very much, Representative Comp, for doing this work. And we will have this back the first week of February. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3619. We are going to take a 5-minute break. So we will come back at 10:10, at which point we will open the public hearing on LC 122. Just to give you a sense, we're going to have the Labor Commissioner and Superintendent are going to give us an explanation of what the bill is. We have a very large number of people who have signed up to testify. We're going to do our best to get through everyone. To accommodate that, we have an egg timer. And after the initial presentation, if you can keep your testimony to 3 minutes, that's what the egg timer will be set for. So thank you, and we are in recess for 5 minutes. Are we gone? All right. The House Committee on Education will come back to order. Thank you. So in education, as this committee, well, I don't know if we've ever experienced controversial bills before where people have had deeply held thoughts and opinions. But whether it's online learning, school for the blind, any of these things, there are few things that can generate as much intense feeling as the issue of schools and religion in exactly the same sentence. The legislative concept that we are considering today would remove a barrier, is intended to remove a barrier that prevents teachers of certain religions from being hired in our public schools simply because they wear religious garb required by their faith. The law that we have in effect is a holdover from the early 1920s and an era where the KKK in our state and many others were strong enough to pass laws preventing the wearing of religious garb. All but two other states in the nation have repealed this law. So we are one of three states in the country that still has this law, and it remains on the Oregon books today. I want to make it clear, and I've realized I haven't opened a hearing, so I'm going to do that really quick. I'd like to open a hearing on LC 122. And in doing that, I also want to make very clear that this is not intended to be a bill about allowing teachers to preach or proselytize to their students. That is never acceptable in schools. If that is something that is happening today, that should be enforced and swift action should be taken. There is no event ever that makes it appropriate to proselytize to students in public schools. This law does not change any of those current restrictions on what a teacher cannot say or do to force or coerce students in matters of religion. That would remain illegal. That is clearly not the intent of repealing a statute that unfairly singles out religious minorities and says because of what you believe and how you look, you cannot teach in our schools. We're going to hear varied testimony today on this issue that raises two very important issues, the issue of religious freedom and religious discrimination, and also the importance of maintaining religious neutrality in our public schools. I hope that as we listen to varied testimony today that we'll be able to keep open minds and remain focused on how we can address these challenges as we move forward into the February session. And we are going to start today with an overview of the bills by our Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian and Superintendent Susan Castillo. So I would welcome you both.
Well, good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon, and I'm here with Commissioner Avakian asking for a repeal of the prohibition on public school teachers wearing religious garments. During the 2009 session, as you're well aware, the legislature passed Senate Bill 786, also known as the Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act, and the commissioner and I have since sent the legislature a letter talking about the need for us to repeal the prohibition on public school teachers wearing religious garments. We need to finish the work on this statute, in our opinion. The statute, in my opinion, is vague in regards to religious dress. I think it confuses the issue of religion and culture expression, and it also, we have concerns about, or I have concerns about the federal interest in concerns about whether or not our statute is in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And so today I want to take a moment to share my thoughts on the inequity of Oregon's current policy toward our public school teachers. And first of all, I want to start by saying that I am a very strong proponent of the separation of church and state. That is what our country is about. I believe the classroom should be free of proselytizing, but I also believe strongly in the freedom of every American to practice their religious beliefs. The challenge, I think, for political leaders is drawing a clear, bright line between what is acceptable religious practice and what is promotion of religious belief in a public school setting. There are other existing restrictions in statute that do provide strong legal protections for our students and the general public against proselytizing in our public schools. And in the rare instance where we have identified that the line has been crossed in Oregon, my agency has taken appropriate action to correct improper practices. The Oxford Dictionary, English Dictionary, defines proselytizing as to convert a person or persons from one belief to another. And I believe that it's a mistake to equate the wearing of religious dress with actively engaging in proselytizing. How a teacher dresses and whether or not they are proselytizing are not connected. Now, some people have raised the issue about how a curious or impressionable student will react to a teacher wearing a burqa, a yarmulke, or a cross. Well, our teachers and our school employees face indelicate questions from students quite often. Questions like, how old are you? What race are you? How much do you weigh? Are you married? Are you gay? And our teachers know how to respond appropriately and professionally. For a teacher, that is part of the job, so I'm hard-pressed to see how our students are being unduly influenced just because they ask such questions. Although current statute prohibits religious dress for classroom teachers, other public school employees are not prohibited from such dress. No other public school employee who works with children in any setting faces such a prohibition. So I want to just ask you to imagine for a moment this hypothetical example that could occur under Oregon law today. You have two school district employees who are assigned to a second grade class. One is a highly qualified, licensed, and certified public school teacher. The other employee is a teaching assistant and a classified employee. Both employees are of the Christian faith. They attend the same church and choose to wear a visible cross identified with their religion. Well, under current Oregon law, only the classified teaching assistant may wear the cross as an expression of their faith and religion, and teachers are not. So please remember that these two school employees will be with the same group of children all day, every day for the entire school year. And if we have such a serious concern about a teacher wearing religious clothing, I am unclear as to why it's acceptable for a teaching assistant in that same classroom to do so. The other point I want to make is that today in Oregon and across our country, we have more cultures and languages and religions in our public schools than we have ever had before at any time in Oregon's history. And yes, teachers are very influential on their students. The research shows us that teachers have the most important influence on our kids. But I believe that we can recognize these demographic changes and still provide protections for everyone in our public schools on the issue of church and state. So I'm here today to ask you to remove an unnecessary and unjustifiable barrier to the religious freedom of one group of Oregonians. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Mr. Labor Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad Avakian, State Labor Commissioner. Madam Chair, I appreciate you holding the hearing on what is an extremely important issue, not just for us today, but an issue that dates clear back to the founding of our country and striking the balance between the individual rights to freely express your religion as opposed to wanting to make sure that government has ample parameters to not being establishing in any particular type of religion. And I appreciate your comment, especially about maintaining neutrality in public schools. Bureau of Labor and Industries ardently feels the same way, that there must be a balance and that balance must result in neutrality in public education. One of the specific reasons the Bureau of Labor has an interest in testifying today is that in the actions that carried this old prohibition forward in the last legislative session was added the provision that a teacher who does wear religious dress and has an adverse employment action taken against them is now precluded in Oregon from filing any type of a claim of discrimination under our civil rights statutes in Chapter 659, which the Bureau of Labor oversees. Now, I think you really have two questions before you. One of them is in maintaining this neutrality in public schools, does the current law add something valuable to that end? And second, if that law is repealed and no longer exists, are there adequate protections otherwise that enable you to have neutrality in public schools? Now, one of the, if you haven't heard of the case yet, you will shortly, I'm sure, the one case that the Oregon Supreme Court has ruled on, Cooper v. Eugene School District, in which the Oregon Supreme Court found this old law constitutional under Oregon Constitution. The most salient point in the case that I think you should take with you is Justice Lindy's quote, that the law might indeed restrict a teacher's First Amendment rights to the free exercise of religion more than necessary if it were applied literally. So what you have before you is a law that within the very text of its language stands the chance of infringing upon the rights of teachers. So you have a valid issue before you. We think that because the law includes the language that any religious expression through dress is precluded, not just that which unduly influenced the neutrality in the classroom, but any dress, that the law should be repealed. It cannot be safely applied as it's written. And because of that, there is great concern that it leaves the state in the position of being challenged either under the federal constitution or Title VII. But whether or not the law is constitutional, whether or not it is otherwise legally valid, we also just believe the law is not good policy. We don't think the committee needs to come to a conclusion on the legality of the law in order to have a reason to repeal it. So what happens if the law is repealed? What does that leave you with regard to protecting the neutrality in public schools? We are, as the Madam Chair said, one of the only states that have such a law on its books anymore. Virtually every state has repealed theirs. One of the reasons is that under the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, teachers and other school personnel are already precluded from taking some type of action, which would include religious dress, that affects the neutrality of religion in their classrooms. The seminal case is Lemon v. Kurtzman, a case decided in 1971 by the United States Supreme Court. It's been added to since then, but its principles are still valid and apply. It gives you a three-part test for maintaining neutrality in public places, including a public school. It says that government action must have at least one secular purpose in order to be valid, that the government action's principal effect cannot inhibit religion or advance religion in, for instance, a school classroom, and that the government cannot excessively tangle itself in religious affairs. So if you repeal the statute, and then a teacher's dress, religious dress, is so pervasive in the classroom as to upset the neutrality of religion, then the Supreme Court test under Lemon v. Kurtzman would preclude it anyway. Given that, the statute really adds very little to your ability to maintain neutrality in the classroom, and if you repeal it, there will be adequate protections under the law anyway. At the Bureau of Labor, we, of course, you know, house the state's civil rights division. So the preserving the individual rights of people in the state, including teachers, I think is of the utmost importance. We think that in a free society, that when you have the choice, you should always lean towards the preservation of constitutional principles for individuals. The question has been raised several times, including this morning, on why do it now? Why not wait till 2011 or some other time? We think you have a situation before you in which you have the strong possibility that the constitutional rights of individual teachers are either in jeopardy or being violated. and that when you have that circumstance, that there should be no reason to wait, that you do have an obligation to act to protect the individual rights. And we feel even more strongly about that because in acting and repealing the statute, you still have other principles like the Lemon v. Kurtzman test that will adequately protect the neutrality in classrooms. With that, we urge a repeal of 342.650 and 342.655 in the February session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And are there questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, and now as we move on to the witness testimony, we have egg timer.
Egg timer.
We're going to do 3 minutes. Yes. It'll beep out loud, so you know that.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. And the first person, we have a member that wanted to speak, Representative Call. I'm glad that you're here, and it would be great if you could model the 3 minute testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nick Call, Representative for House District 49 in Multnomah County, including the communities of Wood Village, Fairview, Troutdale, and North Gresham. That's one of the first times anybody's ever asked me to model anything. I'm here today to give my unequivocal support to this very important piece of legislation. I'm going to cover just a few things and try to make what I think are really succinct arguments, which might be a first. So, first of all, this bill is both under and over-inclusive. We've touched on this a bit already, but I think it's very important that if what we're talking about here is trying to stop proselytizing in schools, this bill really doesn't do a very good job of it. And so by saying that it's both under and over-inclusive, it's under-inclusive because it only applies to teachers and no one else in the school system. It's under-inclusive because it may actually not stop all proselytizing. And it's over-inclusive because it might actually stop people from exercising their First Amendment rights in a way that's completely constitutionally protected, that doesn't have anything to do with proselytizing, but instead is simply limited by this law. And so that's a first major concern, is that this law is very poorly drafted. It doesn't actually do what it sets out to do. And for that reason, I think it should just go away. And now there may be other laws that we should enact to deal with proselytizing in general, but this law doesn't get at the heart of the issue and doesn't protect anybody. In fact, I think it harms people. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I think that the judicial opinion that's out there on this, the Cooper versus Eugene School District, which is Justice Lindy's opinion, actually throws more into confusion than it actually helps. Two things I'd just like to address is I think it's pretty clear under that opinion that you could wear a cross in a classroom or a Star of David. And in fact, you could probably wear the occasional religious dress, but if as a tenet of your faith you wore the same dress day in and day out, you would be in violation of this law and violation of Oregon Constitution, which is also a huge problem because then within this religious community and within this kind of religious dress that we have, only certain communities that wear religious dress as an article of their faith day in and day out are covered by the law. Third thing, this should be for the courts. This is why the courts exist. Individual liberties are complicated. It is unbelievably complicated to try to write a law that deals with this issue. And this law is the perfect example of that, that the judicial system is perfectly geared towards dealing with these issues, and when the legislature step in, they create laws that are both over and under-inclusive, which is why we should simply repeal this law. And then finally, I'd like to say that I'm an Arab American. My dad immigrated from Syria in the 50s. He grew up in a small Christian village on the Mediterranean Sea, and my grandfather used to tell me stories about around the religious holidays, especially Muslim holidays, that in his church they would read from the Quran and talk about the Muslim faith and try to talk about tolerance and inclusion and pluralism. And I just think that we've moved kind of a long ways away from that. We're talking 60 years ago, and this law will increase pluralism.
I have to ask you to wrap up.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was great modeling on the beep. Thank you. And before we move on to the next testimony, we do have a special guest in the back of the room. We have a visit from former Representative John Lim, who has brought a congressman from Korea, yeah, and just wanted to acknowledge him. What is his name?
His name is Bong Gwan Lee, the current national congressman from Korea. Actually, he's from my hometown congressman in Yeo-ju, Korea. He's a guest speaker of the Korean American Day today we are celebrating. Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to Congressman Lee here.
Well, thank you, and welcome to the Capitol, Congressman Lee. And, of course, it is always good to see you, Mr. Lim. And enjoy your day. And can people find the Korean Day activities somewhere in the Capitol today, outside?
In the rotunda.
Wonderful.
If I may, Chair, that if you could maybe recess for 5 to 10 minutes, if you could join us.
I'm sure that people would. As you can see, I think we are going to be challenged to finish this hearing, and we still have another hearing after this one, all to complete by noon.
That's what I heard.
Thank you. Tempting.
안녕하세요.
Very tempting. And before we move on to the next testimony, as you're watching the clock and you think, oh, the hearing doesn't end until noon, we do have a hearing on the Oregon School for the Blind that we'd like to get started no later than between 11:30 and 11:45. So if you're here for that meeting, it's still probably at least another hour out before we get to the hearing on the School for the Blind. So next up, next panel, thank you, Representative Call, for modeling that. You'll hear the beep, and at that point, if you could summarize, meaning 15 seconds, not minutes, that would be great. Our next panel would be Tricia Smith, Charlie Hinkle, and Andrea Meyer. And while people are coming to the dais, you also have written testimony at your place from the Attorney General, from Ron Roberts, from Vicki Chamberlain, and from Steve Green. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Smith.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I appreciate that you have a huge witness list on this bill, and I will be very brief. I have submitted to Dana some written comments, which I've asked her just to give to the committee. OSEA does not currently have a position on LC-122, and that is not to say we are neutral, nor is it to say that we are not opposed to a repeal. That is to say, we simply do not have a position at this moment because we have not had the opportunity to explore what we believe is a very significant issue, seriously enough and thoroughly enough to understand that what we are doing not only protects adults in the classroom and their rights, but it protects children in the classroom and their rights. What this issue and the discussion has done is pointed out that the law needs fixing. We agree with that. We don't believe it makes any sense that an instructional assistant can be in the classroom in any garb she wants, but a teacher cannot. If there is influence on a child, it is an influence that an instructional assistant and a teacher share. A child doesn't understand the difference between the two. So there is some issue with this statute. But what we would ask you to do is please allow us to come sit down all in the same room and work through all of the potential pitfalls of a quick decision, because the only people compelled to be in that classroom are the students. And so their rights must absolutely be protected in a government-run school. And we would ask you to please slow this down just a bit so that we can look at all of the aspects of this issue and make sure that the statute that comes out at the other end works for everyone, including the children and the employees. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Meyer.
I prepared for about 5 minutes, so I will try to do my best. Chair Gelson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to LC-122. We urge the legislature, as others have, to postpone consideration until 2011. The fact that I'm rushing through 3 minutes of testimony is one of the reasons our board urged that this legislature not consider this, because it doesn't allow for full participation and deliberation. You've heard about the anti-Catholic bigotry of the law. It's important to note that the 1965 legislature fully amended this law. It was then signed by then-Governor Mark Hatfield, who, as a state representative, co-sponsored the Oregon Civil Rights Act. And the Oregon Supreme Court in Cooper acknowledged the change in 1965. We certainly recognize the importance of religious liberty, rights of individuals, and to their ability to practice their faith. and we have acted in support of those rights here in Oregon and elsewhere, and will continue to do so. But public schools have a unique and special obligation and role to ensure an atmosphere that is welcoming to all students and their families, regardless of their religious beliefs. I quote from Cooper briefly, "Parents and lawmakers may and do assume that the hours, days, and years spent in school are the time and the place when a young person is most impressionable by the expressed and implicit orthodoxies of the adult community and most sensitive to being perceived as different from the majority of his or her peers. Famous constitutional cases have involved this socializing rather than intellectual function of the schools. In excluding teachers whose dress is a constant and inescapable visual reminder of their religious commitment, laws like this respect and contribute to the child's right to the free exercise and enjoyment of his or her religious opinion or heritage, untroubled by being out of step with their teacher. During the school day, public school teachers are representatives of the government, and their appearance and actions are taken on behalf of the government. And in that context, the government and teachers need to ensure religious neutrality." I want to touch on briefly some of the issues that have been raised, that we will, we are concerned that you will not be able to regulate in any way once and if you repeal this law. It will open Pandora's box because the district and the school and the government will not be able to regulate and inquire as to someone's sincere religious belief if they present themselves wearing religious dress. Steve Green, whose testimony you have on page 4, even acknowledges as a proponent of repealing that you should amend the Workplace Religious Freedom Act in conjunction, because without doing that, the school districts are particularly exposed to liability under the fact that there is no standard if you simply repeal. I understand the issues about restricting to proselytizing. The problem is it's not easy to draw that line, and it's hard to draw that line with a captive audience of young children. As the court said, a distinction between privileged personal expression and forbidden indoctrination or proselytizing is easier to assert than to apply. One teacher's personal views and acts can carry more unintended persuasion than another's most determined teaching efforts. There's a limitation on the current law that we do want to acknowledge. You've heard it already today. Both the
I need you to summarize. I'm sorry,
sure.
Ms. Meyer.
I do want to acknowledge the jewelry, because of the definition of dress is not jewelry. Maybe the fix is to expand the law. Likewise, the scope of teachers. There are too many unanswered questions. We urge that you also take a look at the Attorney General's opinion, who argues that the law is both defensible and this is a complex issue. And again, we hope that if this is brought up in February, I will have a chance to give more deliberative testimony for consideration on this very important and difficult issue where lots of good people on both sides are concerned. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer in practicing in Portland and a minister in the United Church of Christ. I support the statute, which, as Ms. Meyer indicated, was reenacted, reaffirmed in 1965 and signed by Governor Hatfield, a man of deep personal religious convictions and a person who, to as far as I know, has never been accused of religious bigotry. Superintendent Castillo made the mistake this morning of saying that this statute as it exists applies to crosses. You heard Representative Call say that that was not true, and he is correct, and she was mistaken. A teacher can wear a cross under this statute, and the court in the Cooper case said so. But Superintendent Castillo was very much correct, though, in citing the increasing religious diversity of our society. And I think it's important to remember that if this statute is repealed, it is not just the Muslim, not just the Jew, not just the Christian who will be permitted to wear their distinctive religious garb, but the adherents of Wicca and witchcraft, and I've cited a case in the written testimony that I submitted to you. It will be adherents of the Church of Bodily Modification who will be permitted to wear a religious garb in the classroom. They are a group that believes in the necessity of facial jewelry. And more importantly, it will open the door to individual assertions of religious liberty rights to wear religious garb, because the U.S. Supreme Court has made it clear over and over and over again that your religious liberty rights don't depend on whether or not you are adhering to or responding to an institutional mandate. It is your belief that counts. And I have cited in my materials a case involving a Roman Catholic woman who took a vow that she would wear an anti-abortion button with no words on it, just a button that had an aborted fetus or something like that, and she was going to wear it until abortion was declared illegal in this country. And she believed and she testified that the salvation of her soul depended upon her adherence to that solemn vow that she had taken. Now, this was not a mandate from the Pope or from her bishop. It was her individual belief that mandated the wearing of that button. You're going to get instances like that if this law is repealed. And my concern is that you are then going to get pushback. You're going to get pushback from the Christian community who believe, as the Lieutenant Governor of South Carolina said last year, it's time that we as Christians let society know that we are tired of backing down in fear of ridicule. We're under attack. We've got to continue to fight this battle. It shouldn't be freedom of speech for everybody else, but not for us Christians. Ironically, I was at a meeting Saturday night in the Muslim community where strong anger was expressed over the Christian influences in the schools. If this statute is repealed, you're going to have a greater attempt by Christian teachers to respond to the Muslim teacher in the classroom next door.
Uncle, can you work on summarizing, please? I'm sorry.
Don't open this Pandora's box of increasing religious tension and disputation in the public schools. I think this will harm public schools in the long run by more Christian families taking their kids out of the schools rather than have their second grader taught by a woman wearing a witchcraft robe or a insignia of any other religion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gilser. I have a question for Charlie. And this is based on my personal experience as an employer. Years ago, I terminated a teacher, and in the process, ended up with a filing of religious discrimination. And when the facts came out, it started with a dispute between teachers over an opinion about a ballot measure that had some religious connotation for one of them. The facts that were presented in the case was the fact that my Head Start program was located in the educational wing of a church, and there was a picture of Jesus on the wall. And that was, so I pay the attorney, and I go through this whole process of demonstrating that this person was not terminated because of religious discrimination, but for other reasons. And so then I'm looking at this issue in terms of the employer. What does this open up for the employer?
Well, you're going to have arguments about what is religious stress and what is not. You're going to have arguments about whether or not the religious stress is compelled or not. I think one of the great ironies of the proponents is they never explain why it is that everyone believes and concurs in the notion that the free speech rights of public school teachers can and should be restricted in the public school classroom. We don't allow teachers to express their views on vegetarianism or on gay rights or on abortion. If you're hired to teach algebra, you teach algebra, and you don't talk about other things. And so you're going to have enormous factual controversies, Representative Van Orman, about which constitutional right I am asserting here. And by the way, we've heard a couple speakers this morning say that the constitutionality of this statute is in question. That is emphatically not the case. I have a 14-page memo that I gave you, and I'm not going to summarize it. But both the Oregon Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld this statute against constitutional challenges.
And may I follow up with to say that I was not found guilty of discrimination, and the case was closed.
And just to let the committee know, you know we're adhering to a timeline. In that budget of 3 minutes, I've allowed about 10 minutes or so for questions for each panel, so don't feel like you have to hold back. Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'll try to speak fast, but there was it's my understanding there's a law in Pennsylvania that doesn't outright ban. It has exemptions in it. How do you feel about such a law?
It was my understanding, Representative Thatcher, that the Oregon statute was virtually identical to the Pennsylvania statute, so I'm not familiar with the exemptions. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the exemptions would be. Or
I will say that I'm going on what was told to me. I have not read it myself, so I was just wondering if you had any.
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, I believe, and I could be mistaken, that law actually is more inclusive because it specifies religious symbols or jewelry or such, so it is broader in its inclusion, but I'm not aware of any exceptions to that law.
And the constitutionality of that law was upheld, too, by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me say, first of all, that I welcome this conversation. I've been waiting for it since we had our hearings last during the session on the Senate bill that was passed, because it, although I supported that bill, it bothered me that I had to vote, in effect, for an exclusion of classroom teachers. My own grandparents came to this country in order to be able to exercise their religion, and I find the existing law abhorrent. Having said that, I would like us to pursue a little more the difference between the exercise of free speech and the exercise of one's religion. I'm not a lawyer by any means, so please bear with me. But as I understand it, I could wear, let's say, a Star of David, which is telling the world that I am Jewish, and I'm exercising my free speech in doing so. But I cannot wear a head covering, even though my faith says that I must have my head covered, you know, at all times. And I wonder if you could go into the difference there between the two, why it should be okay for me to say, I am a Jew through my wearing a Star of David, but not follow my faith wearing a head covering. And also, well, I'll follow up.
Well, I completely agree with you, Representative Dimbro, and I think that distinction is indefensible. I think that this statute that we have on the books now is under-inclusive, because if you're going to ban the expression of religious belief by what a person is wearing, it doesn't make much sense to say it's all right if what you're wearing is metallic, but not if it is cloth. So I agree with you that the statute ought to be amended. I mean, your view is it ought to be repealed altogether. My view is that the problem ought to be addressed by amending it to include that. I go back to the example I gave, and I cited in my material, of this Roman Catholic woman who sincerely believed that she should wear that anti-abortion button at all times. Would you allow that as a public school teacher? I think that would be a mistake, because I think we should keep sectarian religious influences out of the public school classroom. Many times, Representative Dembrow, our religious beliefs disqualify us from certain kinds of jobs, and probably the most famous case in American history came out of Oregon, the question of the drug counselor who was a member of the Native American church and used peyote as part of his sacred religious ceremonies. No one doubted the sincerity of that practice. No one doubted its history. It had gone back hundreds of years, and yet the U.S. Supreme Court said that as sincere as his religious beliefs might be in the necessity of using peyote as part of that ceremony, he had no right to a job as a drug counselor, and they upheld the state of Oregon's decision to deny him unemployment benefits. So he was penalized. He was restricted from that sphere of employment because of his sincerely held religious beliefs. I don't know of anyone, well, I don't know. I don't know whether you disagree with that or not, but that's the law of the land now.
Follow up, yes. Let me turn to another question. And like many of my colleagues, I often make visits to schools and talk to classes. And since I knew this issue was coming up, I've been asking students in our give and take what they thought about this. And I had a conversation with an eighth grade class at Park Rose High School about a month ago, and a young woman asked me for clarification. So are you saying that it's okay, for example, for a student to wear a head covering but not a teacher? And I said, yes, that was the case. And she said, so are you saying that I'm going to be more influenced by a teacher than I am by another person in my class? And she was really incredulous at that. And I found that really interesting. She really thought I was from another planet in even suggesting that. But, my question is that I know your paper references some studies that were done, which I think the most recent is about 25 years old. I'm wondering if there's been current research on this, but also just that we apparently are one of only two or three states that have such a law on the books as we do. So can you say something about the problems that we're not having in Oregon that other states are having? I mean, are they having a real problem where students are being inappropriately influenced by the fact that their teachers are following their faiths?
Well, I think that's a premise that has not been established. The fact that there are only three states that have a statute on the books doesn't mean that other states permit it. It's a matter of local option, local school board policies. You heard, or you may hear, from an OEA representative saying we don't need this law because other policies, other statutes in effect will address this issue, and that's what happens in other states. I don't know of any state where you will find Roman Catholic nuns in their full habits, or Muslim women in a burqa covered head to toe with only their eyes revealed, who are allowed to teach in the public schools. If this statute is repealed, it will be, I assume, argued that it is legislative intent that that will be permitted in Oregon. Not just the headscarf, but the full dress from head to toe of people of various religions, and they may be witchcraft today and Roman Catholic nuns tomorrow and Muslim women the next day. You had another aspect to that.
Can I just ask a follow-up to that?
Yes.
Has there been an instance of witchcraft in any public school in the United States that you're aware of? Is this something that's actually happened? I've certainly not heard of somebody going to school in full witchcraft garb and spells
either,
on their children.
Fortunately, because there's this law in the books, but there are many Christian parents who object strenuously to the observance of Halloween in the public schools because of its witchcraft connotations. Halloween is, in fact, one of the four sacred holidays for the Wicca religion. And there are great many Christian parents in the state of Oregon who have taken their kids out of the public schools precisely because of the influence of witchcraft
in
the schools.
I think that the point on the question was you had raised that a danger that we might face if we repeal this law is that witches might go into our school dressed as witches. And I'm wondering, has this happened in other places where there has been a problem of the practice of witchcraft by public school teachers during the school day in clothing that suggests that?
No, because as I said to Representative Denbrough, I think all school districts would prohibit that. Everywhere in the country. But if you are repealing this statute, you are signaling that the adherents of any religion, I mean, this is what I said in my opening remarks. If this law is repealed, it's not the Muslim and the Jew and the Christian who are all going to be, it's not going to be limited to them. It's going to be all the proliferation of new religions, and I second entirely what Superintendent Castillo said on that. We've had the experience in Oregon of the Rajneeshis. They were very distinctive in their dress. They took over a public school system. Indeed, they took over the entire city of Antelope. And all of the public school teachers in the Antelope School District were wearing red. And if you were a Christian student, a Muslim student in that classroom, you would feel very much an outsider.
Chair Gelser, can I add briefly to Representative Demarest? And one, I think I want to make clear, I believe OEA has taken no position so on this legislation. So Lori wants to make that clear. The challenge we have comparing Oregon to other states and what they do there, and I agree, and our board has asked what goes on in other states, what are the local policies, rules, practices, and we have yet to get that information, and I will be tasked with that over 2010 if this legislature does not move on it. But Oregon is unique, and I'm not sure, as it was testified earlier, that Lemon v. Kretzmann and First Amendment analysis will even apply here. Oregon Constitution is unique both in its language and its independent interpretation of its meaning, and that's what makes this issue even more complex. And I think that may be reflected in the AG's opinion. We can't necessarily rely on the case law or the analysis of the practices in other states to guide us as to what's permissible and where the lines can be drawn here in Oregon because of our separate and distinct Oregon constitutional protections.
Thank you. Representative, we're going to do Thatcher, Comp, and Van Orman, and then move on to the next panel. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. What I'm sort of hearing from you is if we repealed the law, but put the caveat in there that we leave it to the discretion of individual school districts, that that would be better than just an outright repeal?
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, no, I think that's actually even a worse scenario, and I think if you read the AG's opinion and Stephen Green's analysis, that leaves open the gate, I think Stephen Green mentioned, to liability. I mean, I don't think school districts want to be tasked with having to draw lines, especially with no guidance. The Workplace Religious Freedom Act that was passed in 2009 is not a tool that schools can use. In that law, where an employer can draw a line and say to the employee, that goes too far, I cannot accommodate either your time off or your dress, is under a financial hardship standard. The school districts, that standard does not guide them. That's not useful for them. So there's even no tool in that law, not that that would necessarily satisfy my organization, but even some proponents who think the law should be repealed think there needs to be safeguards. But absent that, even with that, it may be a huge problem, but absent that, I think it's a nightmare, and I would think that the school folks behind us would be saying, don't put that on us. That's just a recipe for liability and litigation and no guidance to either the teachers or the school district.
Representative Pomp, thank you. Just for the record, I do serve a very diverse community, and that happens in many areas. I want to validate what our attorney has stated. When I was an assistant principal at our high school, it came as a request that some students came forward to the administration asking to have their book of witchcraft on the same shelf as the Bible in the library. And so that's a simple example of the discussions that possibly can and have, and you know, we did, we discussed it, and I don't even remember what the decision was from the district, but it certainly is out there.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
And I would like to just illustrate, too, the witchcraft thing, because one time we were transporting voter materials from one center to another, and we had these free Halloween bags. And I asked one of my employees who was going out to Stevenson, I think it was, and I said, could you take this? And she took one look at the bag, and she said, no, no. So it's out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think certainly people are out there, and they have opinions about Halloween. They have opinions That's about right. Christmas. We've clearly heard lots of opinions about Christmas trees and snowmen and holiday trees and all of these other things. I think that that is a different circumstance than what I thought I heard suggested, which was that if we repealed this, we would have a problem with teachers practicing witchcraft in public school coming to school dressed as witches. And I heard you say it doesn't happen because local districts in other states have implemented laws and regulations and not laws, but regulations and dress codes that would preclude that. But then I heard Ms. Meyer say it would be worse if we gave school districts the ability to make a dress code. So I'm just wondering, if this bill moves forward, do you want school districts to have the ability to make some restrictions, or are you wanting there to be no restrictions?
Well, no, Chair, I support this law, and it seems to me you either want a policy by which public school teachers can wear religious dress in the classroom, or you don't. And if you want a policy in which teachers are allowed to wear religious dress in the classroom, my only point is you can't limit it to the establishment religions now. You have to, and that's the reason I've cited these cases, that are actual litigated cases in which members of these other religions have asserted these rights. And, I mean, you cannot say to a Muslim, you can wear your headdress, and to a Christian, you can wear your cross, and then say to a Wiccan, you can't wear the insignia of your religion, or to the Church of Bodily Modification, you can't do your thing, or to the Rajneeshis, you can't wear your thing. I mean, you have to have equality among religious beliefs in this country.
And isn't that the problem that we have today? Because we say today to a public school teacher, you can wear a cross, but the teacher in the next classroom can't wear her headscarf.
I agree with you. That's what I said to Representative Dembro. The law may be under-inclusive. I think, I'll say it for the 100th time, I think all sectarian,
religious influences should be kept out of the public school classroom. I don't want your prayers in there any more than I want my prayers. I don't want your sacred texts in there any more than I want my sacred texts. I don't want your religious garb in there any more than I want my religious garb. And there is a big difference between the student, the fellow student, and the teacher. The teacher is the authority figure, the most important authority figure in a student's life, with the exception of his parents, and often more important than the parents. Teacher said so.
Chair Gelson.
Teacher's right.
I wanted to clarify, I don't think schools can do local policies or dress codes. I think that they would be, that the law opens the door, and as I've written in my testimony, the courts have made it clear legally that school districts or government cannot inquire as to the sincerity of your religious beliefs. If you come wearing a t-shirt that has a cross on it, or other Christian or any other religious insignia beyond the jewelry of any kind of religion, and you say it's your sincere religion, I think the school may be able to say, is that your sincere religious belief? Yes. They can't inquire further. They cannot regulate it further. Indeed, I think because the statute says dress, that Hans Lindy and the Cooper Court was probably correct in the way the law was written, that dress may not mean jewelry, but that doesn't mean that, one, that's not flawed, or two, that there are not many other ways for all religions, including the majority religion, to convey the importance of their religion in dress and outfit and other insignias beyond the small jewelry. You know, it's small jewelry. Would that mean a large dangling of a Star of David or a cross or any other symbol? Those are the lines we don't, and you can't legally draw the line. That's the challenges. The legislature may not be able to, the courts can't, the school district certainly can't, and the U.S. Supreme Court and courts around the country have been clear about the inability to draw those lines easily like that.
Right. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to our next panel. All right, Kevin Finney, Nick Graham, and Sasha Newman Singh. Oh, Khalsa.
Morning.
Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Finney. I'm the Public Policy Director with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I just want to start by acknowledging the contribution to the public dialogue that's been made by our friends in the Sikh and the Muslim community by calling to our attention the discriminatory impact of ORS 342-650 and its questionable history as well. Rather than review all the points I make in the written testimony here, let me just start by addressing a couple of the issues that have come up recently in the discussion here. Our view is that it's not necessary to hold off on moving forward with the repeal of ORS 342-650. We think, and I would really direct you to Steve Green's written testimony on the question of adequate constitutional protections, both in the federal and state constitution, against that preserve religious neutrality. We as a religious organization are one that you will not find here testifying in support of prayer in the public schools or the teaching of intelligent design. We are supportive of separation of church and state. We think this is primarily an issue of respect for diversity, tolerance of difference. We think that it's an issue of hiring discrimination. That it's for that reason that organizations like the Urban League of Portland, the national organizations like the Sikh Coalition and the Sikh American Legal Defense and Education Fund and others are weighing in on this issue in support of repeal. I don't want to imply that moving forward with repeal at this time might not require some public school district attorneys to work overtime figuring out how they should address this issue in the near term. But I think the alternative to repeal is continuing to exclude people who represent religious minority groups from being able to practice their faith and teach in our public schools, and I think that's a a bigger violation of our values. I'm comfortable with the notion that some wearing of religious apparel in the classroom is not going to create a hostile environment for children, as long as it's not coupled with overt proselytization or other acts that are currently and would continue to be forgiven. And the last thing I'll just say is that we do agree at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon with Steve Green's analysis that it might be necessary to include a slight amendment to the Workplace Religious Freedom Act in order to allow school districts to cite their need to comply with establishment clause requirements. And that would be the one additional change that we would see as possibly necessary. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate your time here and hearing this testimony. My name is Nick Graham. I'm the Communications Director with the Oregon Family Council. We represent about 40,000 or so Oregonians, as well as a couple thousand churches around the state that we work with regularly. And I'm here today, of course, to support this repeal that we're discussing. The Oregon Family Council is a strong proponent of religious freedom and religious speech and expression, and we've had a long history of supporting religious freedom throughout the state. Our concern is that we believe this, you know, as it's been stated before, unfairly singles out teachers as opposed to any other employers in the state of employees in the state of Oregon for their religious dress, and that the law is very vague in its application, both in what you can wear and how you can wear it, and I think that creates some issues as well. As discussed in 2009. The legislature passed the Senate Bill 786, Workplace Religious Freedom Act. Of course, it was intended to provide some freedoms for employees in the state of Oregon, but specifically exempted Oregon teachers, Oregon's public teachers. It's our position that no one practicing a deeply held religious belief that is culturally and historically accepted should be forced by law to violate their sacred tradition. The state of Oregon does have a history of recognizing the fundamental rights of religious freedom. There was an example in 2008 where the Oregon court system ruled that the Oregon State Athletic Association actually allowed a Adventist school to shift their game schedules around to compensate for the Sabbath being on a Saturday. And so that actually went to court, and they successfully won the ability to have their games played on another day or another period of time other than during their Sabbath time. And that was just 2 years ago. And, you know, our concern is basically, again, just that this violates our longstanding tradition in Oregon of freedom of religious expression and speech. And we think it's restrictive and discriminatory, and it singles out only this one small group of people, I may not say small, but the Oregon public school teachers. And so, as already discussed, repealing the law would not necessarily just grant wholesale access for teachers to proselytize in the classroom, and we believe that there are ample protections federally, and certainly if there are not locally, those protections could be inserted into local school district policies to avoid those things. We've been a very strong voice to defend religious liberties, and so we are just appealing to you today to pass this law or adopt this concept and repeal this law.
Thank
you very much.
Please.
I offer gratitude to Chairwoman Gelser and all the members of the Education Committee for convening this hearing and also for the opportunity to submit testimony for the record. My name is Sat Hanuman Singh Khalsa. By way of background, I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a lead security officer for the Transportation Security Administration, TSA. And an agency of the United States Department of Homeland Security. I'm here today as a private citizen on behalf of the Sikh American community as the Northwest Regional Director for the Sikh American Legal Defense Fund, SALDEF, as well as other partner organizations, the Sikh Coalition and United Sikhs. As a Sikh American, I support an immediate repeal of ORS 342-650. This unjust law shuts the door on equal opportunity in the face of observant Sikhs, Muslims, and Jews, and others who wear religious dress in adherence to their faith. I am a living testament to the American promise of equal opportunity, but this law is a throwback to the separate but equal doctrine. As a Sikh, my turban is an integral part to my identity as the color of my skin. If I were a teacher, I could not, as required by this law, leave my turban at home to go to work. The Sikh religion was founded in South Asia over 500 centuries ago and currently draws about 25 million adherents throughout the world. The Pew survey estimates there are approximately 700,000 Sikhs living in the United States. Observant Sikhs are distinguished by their turbans, their unshorn hair, and a reputation of being dedicated to the cause of social justice. Our religion teaches us that all human beings are equal, and they are created equal by the one Creator. The Sikh belief in human equality foreshadows the United States Constitution by several centuries. In many ways, at least ideologically speaking, Sikhs are among the most Americans of all Americans. Even still, because of the way we look, Sikh Americans have ironically suffered widespread hate crimes, workplace discrimination, and a school bullying in this post-9/11 environment. In a landmark 1923 Supreme Court case entitled United States versus Bhagat Singh Thind, an Oregonian Sikh was denied the right to become a naturalized citizen of the United States because he was deemed to not be a white person within the meaning of the law. Not surprisingly, around the same time, sympathizers of the Ku Klux Klan and the Oregon legislature enacted the law that would ultimately become ORS 342-650. In our lifetimes, this law continues to impact the lives of teachers in Oregon. A Sikh woman, Kartikar Khalsa, was forced to leave Oregon after being denied the right to teach in 1986. There were several Muslim women who have also been affected by this discriminatory law, three of whom are here today.
I'm sorry that I have to ask you to summarize. Please.
Okay, I'll summarize.
Thank you.
In any nation, the promise of equal opportunity is measured by the extent to which minorities can pursue public service careers. In 2004, after 3 years of struggle, a Sikh man won the right to be a police officer in New York City while wearing his turban. In 2009, after filing a federal lawsuit, a Sikh man won the right to serve as a federal security officer while wearing his turban. In 2009, after many months of struggle, two Sikhs won the right to serve in the United States Army while wearing their turbans. By and by, Sikh Americans, in overcoming barriers to equal opportunity, we urge this legislator to take advantage of this opportunity to join the March of Progress. Thank you.
Thank you very much. But we're going to move on to our next panel. Thank you all very much for coming today. Are there questions for this panel before they go away? I'm sorry. Representative Roebling?
I just had one, and I guess it would be to each. And that was the question that came up in the past one. If
you can come
the,
back.
If the, it, either way, you can just answer. If the interpretation, I mean, in your comments, you talked about culturally and historical religions. There are religions that pop up daily. And if these are repealed, do you see it the same way the other the attorney who spoke earlier, saying that we would also have to protect their rights? This law would be indiscriminate in that way. And so the Wiccan in their dress, the whatever person next dress, and that they would have the same rights as anybody else to wear their garb at a public school.
Well, first of all, I'm not an attorney.
Yet. I know.
Chair Gessler and Representative Roebling, but I would say that certainly school districts, of course, would have the ability to make provisions, potentially to restrict certain types. I don't know. I would also, of course, say that certainly that's possible. Many things are possible. But the effect that it would have in the classroom and the effect that it would have on enrollment and those kinds of effects, I would not really feel comfortable speculating. I really don't know to what extent there would be a widespread challenge, or maybe not widespread.
I'm just saying, would you be there to defend that person's right to wear their clothes is what I'm asking.
We would, certainly. Our goal is to make sure that all Oregonians can practice freely their religious practices as much as possible.
I'm sorry.
I'm a little hard of hearing today, so I didn't catch the question.
The question was, in the previous testimony, we had a statement that once these were repealed, then any person ascribing to a particular religion their dress would have to be protected. So it could mean Wiccan was the expansion they had. There was another one about bodily jewelry. There may be a new religion that starts tomorrow that has some religious expression of their garb. Would you be there to protect those people to be teachers at the same rate that everybody else that we're talking about right now?
Well, we as an organization don't generally engage in legal representation.
Right.
So I doubt we would, in that sense, be there. I would just say that whatever regulations are adopted by school districts, I would think would have to be neutral in terms of their impact on religions. But that isn't to say there wouldn't be some legitimate regulation of garb that might take place in the absence of this statute. I would point again to the fact that 47 states seem to be getting by just fine without a statute of this kind. And I would also just say that I think that to the extent that any other additional statutory enactments might be necessary to address this, we'll know that better after this is repealed and school districts have grappled a little bit with the issue than we would just by kind of discussing it in the near term here.
If I could just clarify, too, just my response. I do want to clarify that we wouldn't necessarily defend them legally.
I know, I don't mean that.
We would be supportive of their right.
That's correct.
Right. And I also believe that, you know, it's our opinion that the courts would also be supportive of their right to do so.
Okay.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I think the question that arises out of this conversation for me, and I don't know, and I don't expect you to have an answer, and I am posing the question, that if the law is repealed and it is then placed upon all these individual school districts, where is the protection for the school district? Is it better protection for a school district to have a state support legislation, or is it better for the school districts to make those decisions on their own, knowing full well that they are going to face the same kinds of legal problems that could arise? So that's just a question I have. You know, does this place the school districts in a difficult position because the state is not behind them anymore?
I would say that Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative Van Orman, I would venture to say that the school districts are in a tough spot either way.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you for your testimony today. Our next panel is Saba Ahmed, Yasemin Kandelin, and Salahuddin Ali. And if I've mispronounced names, I apologize. And then I also was passed a note to make a clarification. A party made a statement that OEA has taken a position of neutrality. Representatives from OEA passed up a note to say that they have not affirmatively taken a position of neutrality.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Saba Ahmed, and I represent today the Oregon Muslim Citizens Alliance, Islamic Society of Greater Portland, Oregon League of Minority Voters, and the National Lawyers Guild. I recently graduated from law school and I'm taking the bar exam next month. I've been working on this issue for the past several months with several of our teachers who have faced discrimination and are currently being denied jobs, and you will be hearing from some of them later today. I have submitted written testimony which shows why we believe legally this law is unconstitutional based on the void for vagueness and overbreadth reasons, because the word religious dress is not defined anywhere in the Constitution. Every school district currently has their own interpretation of this statute. What is allowed in Woodburn School District's Russian Orthodox Christian teachers are allowed to wear headscarves, while in other school districts, Muslim women who choose to wear headscarves are not allowed. And we believe that this law is very, because of the application of the law is not consistent, it should be held unenforceable. We are working with the U.S. Justice Department Civil Rights Division. I was surprised to hear about our Attorney General possibly saying that he will defend, but the U.S. Justice Department, the Civil Rights Division, is looking into challenging the law on behalf of some of our teachers who have faced discrimination. And we hope, we've been working with Speaker Hunt to introduce legislation so that we don't have to go through the judicial route, because even in the 1986 decision of Janet Cooper case, there was Justice Lindy indicated this is more of a legislative issue than a judicial issue. Issues are usually decided on a per case by case basis, and we're more looking into just generally repealing this law. And being a Muslim woman, on my written testimony, I indicated we have over 1.82 billion adherents worldwide. In Oregon, we have over 28,000 Muslims. And hijab and headscarves is part of our, it's an integral part of our faith. It's a means of modesty, privacy, and morality. And it's a requirement of the religion for both men and women to wear modest attire. And I hope that the legislator will repeal this law as soon as possible.
Thank you. Thank you very much. No, that didn't run all the way down. Do I have to let it go to get to 3 minutes again?
Is that anything? Hi, I'm on the WFPU here.
Can you move the microphone a little closer so that we can hear you, please? Thank you.
My name is Yasmin Kendall. I came to America 10 years ago as a reason to came here to continue my education, because of I came as a country they don't allow the woman go with a headscarf, and when I came here I found all the welcoming, and through all my education I learned the one thing here, I can live my religious freedom. And I finished my education as it I always it was my dream to be a teacher, and made my dream come true. Then I try to apply for the job as a teacher in the public school, but I didn't get the result yet. I'm just still waiting. I'm working in a private school now. And one thing I would like to say that is Muslim people in Muslim lands often envy that the liberties that American people enjoy on daily basis in their life here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Morning to the committee. My name is Salahuddin Ali. I'm here representing the Oregon Citizens Muslim Citizens Alliance and concerned Muslim law students at Lewis and Clark. I have to say I wish I was in Saba's position where I could be studying for the bar right now, but I have a year left to go through law school, which I'm really not looking forward to at this moment. But I'm basically here to, as a concerned citizen of Oregon, I live in Portland, to state my support of the legislative measure LC-122 to appeal this law. And this for three reasons. And it would have to be it's in violation of the U.S. Constitution and the Oregon Constitution analysis of a strict standard, which supplies that you have to have a compelling government interest. It has to be applied narrowly and achieve its goal, and there can't be any less restrictive means to accomplish the goal. And I would say that the first one about compelling government interest, we've seen from opposition of this legislative measure that fear of opening a Pandora's box. Now, I'd say what's in that Pandora's box is, a Wiccan will be able to start preaching their Wiccan religion, or a Muslim will start saying their prayer. I would say right now you're comparing apples to oranges. No one's asking to say their prayers. No one's asking to read out of their textbooks. We're just asking to complete their identity of who they are. And what that means is let them complete their identity, and it can be regulated by a strict standard written into the bill. Written in professional regulations, about their conduct. They're going to be teaching from a curriculum. If they're teaching math, they're going to be teaching math. They're going to be teaching English. They're not going to be teaching out of the religious text. It's done in every other profession, as we've seen with the young man that's from the TSA. he's not there doing anything that has to do with his religion. He's just doing his job. The second one about being narrowly tailored, I've just seen teachers in Woodburn are allowed to wear scarves, but not Muslim women in Portland. And this law is not accomplishing what it's supposed to do. It's not being narrowly tailored in accomplishing its goal. As we see from the court case of Cooper, the judge even says that common decorations that a person might draw from their religious heritage is common because it's accepted because it's been being done for a long time. In 1986, I don't believe that women wearing hijabs or Sikhs wearing turbans in classrooms was very much of a common thing, but it can be. Yes, and to apply narrowly, so right now, people are allowed to wear an overt statement of their religion as a Star of David or a cross, or a diamond-encrusted Allah chain that just blings to the classroom. They can say, look, I'm Muslim, but you can't wear a scarf where someone might make an ill-informed assumption that you're wearing it for those reasons. Wearing a hijab or wearing a scarf or a turban or any other religious dress for your identification is not an overt statement. What we're talking about here is conduct. Is the teacher going to proselytize? Because the concern was, in the case, and what the judge was saying about the bill is the teacher going to, is the school perceived to be sponsoring this?
I need to ask you to summarize, please.
Okay, well, the last point is the least destructive measure, and I believe that you can actually write a professional code of conduct like there is in other professions to get rid of the fear that they're going to be, proselytizing. And the last point I want to say is I believe that this is a constitutional challenge because the Cooper case was not upheld by the U.S. The information just came to me. It was not upheld. It was just dismissed for lack of federal question, and those are two different things.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, maybe I missed it. I don't recall anybody saying that they had a fear of somebody proselytizing. I heard them say they had a fear of, well, not stated necessarily that way, but there were concerns about opening it up to all kinds of other statements of religious belonging. Like, there are some who choose not to wear clothes, you know, no garb. So is that going to be opened up? So I'm just wondering how you would draw the line.
Well, I think the line can be drawn between what is conduct and what is just identification. Wearing an abortion button is saying there's a political message. I want you to support my movement. No one's asking, if someone wearing a scarf isn't saying, God is great on there. That's a statement. It might be on clothes, but we're dealing with semantics there. It might actually be on a cloth, but it's not clothes, it's a statement. And so that's where the line should be drawn. What's conduct and what's actually just part of your identity? Someone wearing a Wiccan chain or someone wearing a Wiccan dress, a witch dress or a robe, or whatever it may be, that's dress. That's not a statement. And right now I just see it's unfair that someone can actually wear a Star of David or Allah chain and say, I am a Muslim, I am a Christian, I am a Jew, I am Wiccan, but just wearing a scarf where someone would have to make an assumption isn't. So, that's the line between conduct and identification.
And I'd just like to add that the Teachers' Conduct and Practices Commission already has regulations in place to monitor teacher conduct in the classroom. For instance, political speech and religious speech is already monitored. We have regulations. The Teachers' Licensing Board has those in place. So we don't, I think, need to go more into detail with that. 47 other states also have Teachers' Licensing Board. And Mark Toledo, the general counsel for the OEA, does I've been on panels with him on several occasions, and he has alluded that it would be hard to defend this law as it currently stands.
And I can see OEA in the back. It's the second panel that's alluded to OEA's position, and I think they would prefer to speak to their own position rather than having proponents for or against the measure propel their opinion.
Sure. One other comment I had was Governor Kulongoski also signed this bill earlier this year, so stating 1965, Governor Matt Hatfield also did. But I have been in conversations with the governor's office, and they do support the repeal, although they have not issued any official position. Danny Santos is the Labor Policy Director who has indicated that.
All right. Thank you. And I don't think we have anything officially from the governor's office up here. Are there any questions for this? Further questions for this panel? We're really running out of time. Representative Dimbro?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one point. To the two teachers, or Sabi, you're a teacher also, yes?
I volunteer as
a teacher. the point has been raised, not today, but I've heard it elsewhere, that people can still have, you're driven by a desire to teach, which is wonderful, but people can still teach in a private school. Why is it so important that you be able to teach in a public school and still follow your faith?
I think it's just as important. I've worked at Intel, and I volunteer in the Beaverton School District, and I teach third graders math and science projects, and we love doing science projects. I've never seen it as an issue that the public school kids seem to have an issue with. They just, you know, and I have submitted written testimony from a public school teacher who does wear a headscarf. Her name is Tagreed El-Malgi, and she talked about her experience currently working and facing discrimination at the time that she was hired. She was hired under cultural exception to this law, and I did also submit the written testimony of Mur Kavasaki, who was a Turkish member of parliament who was fired, and her citizenship right was taken away, and she came back to the United States because of her right to wear a headscarf was denied in the Turkish parliament. And so this issue has a much broader effect, and we hope that we move towards religious accommodation and diversity at all levels, public, private sector.
Yeah.
Can I make a small
comment? And we have one more panel, and we still have another bill. Oh. So
it would be it's real small to answer the question. I volunteer and teach debate at school for after school programs, and I would say the most important reason why we'd want to be able to wear a kufi or hijab or something like that in a public school is because Muslims are part of American society, and you shouldn't be segregated off and say, well, you have that right in private schools, but you can't have it as part of a mainstream American society. And in order to make our country greater, you should have mainstream acceptance of people different and show the strength of diversity in the United States and progress it forward.
Thank you all very, very much. All right, we have one more panel. Wow, I can't read my own handwriting here. Layla Zahedi, Greg Hamilton, and Runina Ahmed. Thank you. And you can go ahead and
Thank you very much for inviting me there. And I came here on behalf of my Muslim community. I am a board member of Islamic Society of Greater Portland.
Did you state your name for the record?
I'm Rumina Ahmed.
Thank you.
I'm mother of Saba also. And I taught in this public school as a substitute teacher in Connecticut for 1.5 years. I taught in BCC Sylvania, Cascade, Tillamook College, chemistry. I'm a chemist. And I taught 2-3 years in the Islamic School of Spokane, a private school. I wanted to be a teacher, but I started my certification, but I quit when I came to know that teachers are not allowed to wear hijab in public school. I go as a volunteer, as a judge in Intel Science Fair. I mentor science students, no matter they are Muslim or non-Muslim. I help them. But it is now I'm talking on behalf of hundreds and hundreds of daughters and girls who are wearing hijab, and they are in the public school. Public school, we are thankful to the principal and and other administration. They provide them separate rooms to pray their noon prayer and afternoon prayer. They regard their Ramadan, but they have a passion to teach in the public school in future. They cannot adopt that profession. It is sad. I am talking on behalf of all those girls. Now the Muslim community in 10 years, it is increased from 10,000 to 28,000. Lots of new immigrants are coming from Iraq, from Bosnia, from Afghanistan and other countries. And I know personally more than 300 families who are my friends. There are a lot of girls. There are a lot of women. They are highly qualified. They want to be a teacher. They cannot apply even as a substitute teacher because of their headscarf. Headscarf has nothing to do with teacher. When I teach, all the time I was concentrating concentrating on my curriculum, what I have to teach, chemistry. And I, especially in the PCC college, I always ran out of time. I wish I could have more time to teach my student more knowledge about my chemistry. But I have to limit my... in office hour, I have only 1 hour. Sometimes I spend 3-4 hours to satisfy my students. And same is the case with every teacher. Students, I start from preschool to college level. Students don't care what you are wearing. It's just that a doctor is wearing white coat and the judge is wearing a black robe and the teachers are on commencement, they are wearing... okay, I'm so please, I request you to please repeal this law as soon as possible and let the girls to teach in a public school. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right at 3 minutes.
All right.
And if you'll start by stating your name for the record, that would be helpful.
My name is Lalu Zahedi, and thank you for this opportunity. I teach an Islamic school at an Islamic school in Portland, my home is 50 miles away from Portland. I live in Zigzag, Oregon. I cannot teach in public schools because of my religion, because I am required to wear the head cover. This is not an option for me. I have to wear it. As a result, the only place that I can work actually is private sectarian school. I think the prison law should be repealed. I agree that public school teachers should not openly support or endorse any particular religion in the classroom. But I don't believe modest Muslim dress or other religions dress, for that matter, crosses that line. Modesty, specifically covering the hair, does not convey a religious message. Rather, it merely reflects the character of the individual. Again, please consider repealing this unfair law. I have prepared written comments that you should have it by now, and I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Please, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Greg Hamilton. I serve as president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. We represent the constitutional and workplace discrimination concerns of all people of faith in Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. I'll be really quick. I just want to reiterate, I mean, all the points have been made, and we support the repeal of Oregon Statute 342-650. But I just want to reiterate that this statute is an unreasonable blanket prohibition on religious dress and does not make the key distinction between that which is an innate cultural and religious expression of identity versus overt religious messages whose intent is to proselytize. To me, it's that simple, and I think we have to draw this law, in my opinion, is an untenable law that violates the proper balance between religious free speech and Establishment Clause prohibitions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Well, thank you all very much. I believe that I have exhausted the list. Is there anyone that signed up that I failed to call? Seeing no one. Right. Colleagues, we've heard a lot today. You also have even more written testimony in front of you. We will be having more hearings, more public hearings on this in February, when we will have a little bit more time, not a whole lot more time, but a little bit more time. And so I know we will be hearing from some folks again at that point. Are there any other comments on this issue for the good of the order before I close the public hearing? Great. Well, with that, I will close the public hearing on LC-122. And now I'm going to open a public hearing on LC-127. Do we have, does the committee have the latest update of 127?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. So, and we're going to call up Cindy Hunt and Morgan Allen. Briefly, LC-127, to give you a sense of what it is, it addresses two separate issues in one single bill. The first is that you'll remember a bill that we had last session related to the closure of the Oregon School for the Blind. And one of the principles and priorities that we had was to hold school districts harmless
when a student moved to their district. So one of those places, and we've spent a lot of time clarifying this to local districts in the last couple of months, is that there's a donut hole between when a school district's reimbursement for their ADM is exhausted and when the high-cost disability grant kicks in. So we have been, in the cases that that is applied, we've been paying for that with the blind and visually impaired fund. We've realized that we need to make a clarification that those expenditures from the blind and visually impaired fund count towards getting to that threshold for the high-cost disability grant. And we were still working on that last night to get it exactly right. But again, it's not a change in policy. It's not a change from what we were doing last summer. It's to ensure that we are able to cover all of those costs. The second piece in this bill, and Morgan and Cindy will be able to talk more about it, you'll remember when we sent the school closure bill out of this committee, we had had a provision in the House bill that would have taken all of the proceeds of the sale of the Oregon School for the Blind and put them into a trust fund for blind and visually impaired students. And as you know, that is something that was changed in another part of this building. We continued discussions about that over the course of the year because obviously there's not been a sale and those proceeds have not been distributed to the Educational Stability Fund, I believe is where it was allocated. So this proposal comes both out of that ongoing conversation and an ongoing discussion about three particular parcels of property that we also heard something about last spring, and this would have the effect of taking any proceeds from the sale of the Oregon School for the Blind, splitting all of those proceeds in half, sending half to the Oregon School for the Deaf for necessary capital repairs on that campus, and taking the other half of the proceeds and depositing those directly in the blind and visually impaired fund. So in effect, not sending any of them to the Educational Stability Fund. And with that, I would turn to Cindy and Morgan.
Well, thank you, Chair Gelser. We may not be needed. You did a very good job explaining exactly what we were going to say. But just to provide the committee a little bit more background, the High-Cost Disability Fund, the legislature has made a policy decision to set aside $18 million per biennium from off the top of the state school fund, essentially as an insurance pool or an insurance fund for school districts who have students whose educational needs exceed $30,000. So if you have a student with serious educational needs, perhaps a one-on-one aid, you know, other types of educational interventions, and that cost exceeds $30,000, your school district can apply for reimbursement out of the High-Cost Disability Fund. Right now, the High-Cost Disability Fund, again, $18 million a year, $36 million a biennium. That was increased during the 2000 session. We upped that from $24 million to $36 million during the 2007 session. So the good news is there's this protection for school districts when they get very educationally expensive students. One part of the reason we're talking about this today is that High-Cost Disability Fund during the 2008-2009 school year covered about 80 cents on the dollar per claim. That is, there were far more claims against that high-cost disability fund pool than there was money available to pay it. So districts basically get a prorated once all the claims come in and we add them all up, you get a prorated amount that you've requested. And as Representative Gelser very ably explained, the clear legislative intent of this body in the passage of House Bill 2834 was that school districts for that cohort of roughly 28 Oregon School for the Blind students, that any of their educational expenses would be covered. And as Representative Gelser described, and I'm going to play a little bit loose with the numbers, but for students with disabilities, you roughly get double weighting. It's a little bit more complex than that. There's caps and other things, but essentially you get two times the amount of school funding for students with disabilities. And that's roughly, you know, if the 80 BMW for districts $6,000 to $7,000, you're getting somewhere between $12,000 and $14,000 for students with special needs. But you also heard me earlier say that the high cost disability fund doesn't kick in until $30,000. So essentially school districts eat that roughly $15,000 or so between their double weighting for students with special needs and the time that high cost disability fund kicks in. And so what LC-127 would do is it would allow districts that have those students from the Oregon School for the Blind to make a claim against the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund to cover that donut hole, so they're not out of pocket for those students coming back to their district. And I think that's very consistent with the policy statements we heard in this committee and in the Ways and Means Committee. So that's the first part of it. And I'd stop there and ask for any questions.
There are questions on that piece?
No, he's absolutely right.
yeah.
Oh, but Representative Crump does have a question.
Well, it's not necessarily a question, and I mean, I thought, like what was just testified, that we were very clear about that intent. Do we need to state that again on the record or not?
Good point. I believe that what happened, the intent was very, very clear, but in an effort to make sure that all of the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, this was an issue that existed in the high-cost disability grant. And since it talked about a school district spending up to that $30,000, since the check would be written by the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund, we wanted to make sure the school district wasn't penalized for that revenue stream coming from a different direction.
So this is a guarantee that that is exactly the rules that happen.
I think it does one more thing too. Actually, I think there are school districts who have blind and visually impaired students who are not at the School of the Blind, and they may assume that they get some of that money too. This will clearly state they don't. It's only those 26 kids that get that gap fixed. I believe, is that true?
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin, Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. In the Blind and Visually Impaired Student Fund, the priority is given to the former students who are blind, but there's also some allowance for all of the other kids who are blind or visually impaired. In the High-Cost Disabilities Fund, of course, any child with a special education, you know, has access to that.
I think the distinction that you're making, though, in terms of where that gap gets paid, that gap is paid for the 28 kids who are at the school for the blind. For sure.
Others, it may or may not happen. Right. It depends on what's there. Okay, that's fair.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. So essentially what we're doing is we're running up against a prior policy, and that we're making, and so we're clarifying it to indicate that those 28 kids do get what we expected them to get.
And Chair Gelser and Representative Van Arman, essentially, and Cindy Kirkreifer, with the way the high-cost disability statute reads, is that the districts have to spend that donut hole, essentially, before they can qualify for high-cost disability. So if they're reimbursed by the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund to cover that donut hole, they haven't expended any money to make them qualify for the high-cost disability fund under the statute. And
this will allow them to do that.
And it will make it...
I think I understand.
And this should finally make it absolutely clear to all of the districts that are out there that are having kids come back that we are reimbursing them for any additional expense. I know Representative Van Orman and I and the superintendent have had several very direct conversations with special education directors and superintendents following our November meeting, and this should end any question that is back out there, and families can recognize the resources there to pay and should be expecting that of their districts.
All right. We'll move.
Okay, part two.
Part two. We'll move on to part two, and this is, as I mentioned, I believe, at one of the earlier updates, there was a lawsuit filed against the Department of Education in regards to two of the parcels on the Oregon School for the Blind property that make up roughly 10% of the property size of the Oregon School for the Blind, and I obviously can't get into specifics because it's still a pending piece of litigation, but suffice it to say we've been working with Department of Justice, and we've had very amicable conversations with the plaintiff's attorneys and their representatives about how to resolve that. And one interesting thing that has come up, essentially, I think basically what you heard probably during the testimony and debate over House Bill 2834 is you heard the opponents of closure saying that these two parcels or the proceeds from those two parcels belong to the heirs who donated the parcels. And you had ODE and DOJ saying that the proceeds from those two parcels belong to the state. Well, as further investigation has uncovered, neither of us were correct. And actually, what the Department of Justice has a charitable trust division and has determined that under the current statute and the current law, if those parcels are sold, then the value of that money should go to the Oregon School for the Deaf in its entirety. So in an attempt to sort of honor I think some of the original legislative intents, the earlier versions of the bill, you know, work with the plaintiffs and come to a satisfactory resolution. I think this is a policy choice that will not only benefit the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund, offer probably several $1 million in replenishment to the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund. It's funds that will help make some badly needed repairs at the Oregon School for the Deaf. As you've heard me talk about before, the Oregon School for the Deaf is a unique situation where there's constitutional restrictions from them qualifying for construction
funds and other things like that. And unless the legislature has a few, more than a few million dollars sitting around to make some very needed repairs at the Oregon School for the Deaf out of general fund, that's probably going to continue to be delayed, just like it is for many other schools in Oregon. So I think this is an attempt to bring satisfaction to the plaintiffs. I think it's also an attempt to respect the charitable trust that exists as determined by the Department of Justice. And I think, you know, it's really, I think, a good example of all a bunch of people who did not agree on the underlying bill sort of sitting down and talking through their differences and hopefully coming to a resolution that will be positive. So we'll see what those folks have to say. I can't speak for them, but we feel like at the Department of Education and certainly the legislature I'm working on this have made a very good faith effort to bring that to a resolution. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
And I think the one thing that I would add to that is what came to us from the Department of Ed and the Department of Justice was that we could put together a bill that would make the split for those two parcels of property. And what we have worked on is brokering some agreement and support in the building to expand that to the entire proceed of the sale and getting back closer to that original intent of the House bill that was sent out of this committee. So are there questions or some comments?
The question I have is, these are two, to me, very two different concepts bundled together as one. So if you like one but you have a little struggle with the other, it's just, it's awkward to say the least. Why was it combined rather than separated into two bills?
Well, I think, you know, I can't definitively answer that question, Representative Comp. I think probably just because we're in February and there's limited number of bill drafts and the timing and things like that, and they are somewhat interrelated that they both relate to legislative changes that impact one underlying bill. They're both very directly related to House Bill 2834. That would be my best explanation.
Okay. Thank you. And I think the process explanation is a good one. When we went through the process of having to have approved what we were allowed to request to be drafted from legislative counsel, we were working on the property piece, but it wasn't clear that we needed that high-cost disability piece. I would argue that both of the pieces, for very different reasons, meet the definition of emergency for February and shouldn't wait until the next year. So if it came to choosing between one or the other, rather than putting them together in a bill, it'd be like splitting the baby.
Well, I'd make a political statement, but I won't. No, that's fine.
Okay. There are further questions? Comments? Do we have anybody signed up?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. All right, so we will come back in February and have these introduced. We will come back, and I know that every other committee has gone through this process. We'll have a floor session in the morning, come in to introduce our bills and be able to start first hearing those bills on Wednesday. We will be a Monday, Wednesday, Friday committee from 1 to 3 o'clock, and as you can see, we are going to have a fairly heavy agenda. We have 4 full meetings in which we need to do all of our public hearings and complete our work sessions. Everything needs to be passed out of this committee by that following Wednesday, and I believe that the fiscal and revenue statement rules still apply.
Yep, they do.
So, great. Thank you very much.
Close the hearing first.
Oh, and I will close the hearing on LC 127. And the House Committee on Education is adjourned.
Right on time.
Look at that. 4